O. Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history. Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Brothers, sisters, working class heroes, this is the Rick Smith Show on the road, the People's Tour for America. I'm sitting here in the front seat, Pat LaMarche next to me. An amazing tour thus far, coming to an end soon, though.
How's that making you feel?
Sad, because, you know, we've met so many great people, unearthed so many great stories, things that, you know, as someone who prides myself in knowing a bit about labor history, things that even I didn't know.
That's remarkable because you did, at least walking into all these experiences, you knew what you were going there to talk about. And that was pretty good because, I mean, I was a history major and I have a master's degree in history. And I didn't know 99% of it.
And for me, the great part of this isn't going to end when we finish up here at the end of the week. This is kind of just the beginning because we're going to have to go back and revisit the vast majority of the tour and really, you know, the things that we didn't have time really to cover as much as I would like to go back and focus on that a little bit more as the months and years go by.
You really could have done a 60-day tour and not added a location. You know, this could easily have been 2 months devoted to these exact same locations. And you still would have been pressed for time.
And that's the thing that's another regret I have. I would have loved to have spent much more time in each place, unearthing more, getting further in depth, especially the presidential libraries and a couple we didn't get to go to. I guess it gives us material for the next time.
Oh, the next time, huh?
See how optimistic I am?
Well, it's funny because, you know, a lot of people who spoke to us, they said, oh, I wish I'd known. I would have gotten Fred or Betty or Wilma or somebody to, you know. And if we'd had another day, we could have set that second day aside for those impromptu interviews, people that they thought, oh, you should have really gotten a chance to talk to so-and-so. But, of course, we didn't because 15 minutes later, we were on the road to our next location.
And that's the part of this that, you know, I wish we had more time. But like anything, you know, it's like my grandmother always said, you know, be happy that you want to go back.
That's true.
You know,
she's right.
Instead of, you know, having outstayed your welcome, be glad that you still want to be there so that you have a reason to go back. And I'm
a little
really
message for our politicians, I think.
And I'm really looking forward to going back and revisiting a lot of these sites. Once I've done a little bit more research of the places that I've recently discovered. I think it's part of that learning experience that I so think is important, that experiential hands-on learning that I so value.
And all these highways, I mean, it doesn't matter what city or state you're in, you still, one set of your wheels is on the solid line, the other set of your wheels is on the dashed line, and all of these highways connected state after state, area after area, all of them built by individuals. That's what I used to feel about the pyramids, and really hadn't felt about anything modern about until now, until this tour. You know, all of this, all of the rail lines that are connected to all the other rail lines, even just all these fast food workers who are connected to the fast food workers at a location in another state. All these people doing a thankless job, not remembered, not thought about again. I mean, you roll by a highway in one state and you get onto the highway in the next state, you don't think about the people who built that highway. You sure don't connect them in your mind.
So as somebody who, you know, just came on board, what are your thoughts of the tour thus far?
Well, definitely that we could have used a lot more time. I think my biggest joy of the trip has been your children. I think that they've been amazingly excellent kids, incredibly well-behaved. Well, sure, they screamed, fought, hollered, yelled. They did everything kids do, but they did it driving 500, 700, 900 miles a day and with a great attitude. Every single time I saw them for the first time in the morning, they were happy to be, you know. I mean, what kids survive this sort of a thing in that kind of an upbeat fashion? I thought the kids were fabulous.
I think that's a testament to their mother.
your wife was pretty wonderful, too. That was pretty wonderful. I mean, we had a movie night and all decorated ourselves with glow sticks. We had another night where we did fingernails and toenails with the girls. You know, we had all these different things we did that were still part of a vacation, and all of that at the same time we're doing this other thing. That was pretty amazing. And literally just how wonderful the people were that we interviewed. Person after person after person with personal stories, a wealth of knowledge of history, really dedicated to their union and dedicated, knowing that that's why they had a middle class. They knew they were from the middle class because of people that had worked really hard and fought for them to have one. Yeah. That was pretty impressive.
So over the next couple of hours, we're gonna play the interviews that we did while we were in St. Louis and a few while we were in Detroit. We will be back tomorrow with more, probably from Detroit, some from Toledo, maybe a bit or two from Cleveland, but we're still on the road. And the People's Tour for America, if you want to see where we've been, where we're going, that's where you want to go to check out the information. And as well, listen to the podcast. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Happy holidays, everyone. I'm Rick Smith, and I'd like to invite you to tune in here each and every night through the remainder of 2013 for encore performances of our People's Tour for America.
And I'm Pat LaMarche. I traveled with Rick and his family this past summer on the People's Tour, and we met some pretty amazing folks. So from now until 2014, you'll be able to hear those folks tell their story of how the middle class grew in their part of America. Join us right here weeknights from 9 till midnight.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.org. For America has found its way all the way to St. Louis, Missouri, right through the massive arch. Love that. Not sure what it is, and we're going to find out, but I like it.
If you go inside it, you shouldn't be claustrophobic. That's all I have to say.
Well, we're going to have to give it a try. Anyway, we're here at Teamsters Joint Council 13 here in St. Louis, also the home of Local 618, International Brotherhood of Teamsters. And, you know, a great facility, a nice place. And I'm happy to see that there's so many people here to talk to us today. I'm really thrilled. I've got Roy Gillespie. He's somebody that I got to tell you, great respect. He's the head of the Joint Council 13's Human Rights Commission and Special Events. He's the national lead for disasters for the IBT. He's known as the Master of Disaster because of his work on disaster relief. Roy, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick. I admire you and I admire your show and admire what you're doing.
Thanks so much. The master of disaster. That, in a good way, I assume.
Yeah, one of the local newspapers here did a story about me going to Joplin. And when they did the story, somehow they called me the master of disasters for the work that I've done in disasters in 9/11, Katrina, Sandy, the Oklahoma tornadoes, the Joplin tornadoes, and a lot of disasters nationwide.
You know, I'm surprised that, you know, because most of the, what you see in the corporate-controlled mainstream media is negative when it comes to labor unions and the work that they do. You very rarely ever see the good that unions do. So I'm kind of surprised to hear that the local paper would pick up on that.
It did. They wanted to give it more of a local flair to it, but they also wanted to know more about what labor does, what labor brings to the table in a disaster.
So do we.
Yeah, so do we.
Oh, well, good. Would you like to know?
Absolutely.
Well, this is a great place to talk about it. We work with the American Red Cross, FEMA, and all different agencies and partner services with along with American Red Cross on a disaster. I'm on the National Alert Team. We go in, and when you have a disaster in an area, a lot of times your command center needs electricity. Who do you call? An electrician. Electricians Union. They need stairs built for people that have been displaced, that are in large community centers that are being used for shelters. That's where the carpenters come in. They build the steps. My job is to coordinate, to look at what job is put and is presented to make people's lives comfortable and see what labor union do they need to call that will step up. I've never gotten a no from any labor union. They've always had volunteers that wanted to help and come out and help.
Oh, but Roy, haven't you heard the story? I mean, after Sandy, all the story was is that that New Jersey sent those electricians away. You remember that?
You know, I'm shocked. Why aren't they calling the Bloombergs? Why aren't they calling the Walton family? Why don't they go fix the disaster? They're the ones with all the money.
Well, that's who they call. They call the union people and stuff. You know, it's just like anything else, and people don't realize about unions. When you're sick, you call a doctor. When you're in trouble, you call a lawyer. When somebody's abusing you, you call the police. And when you have problems in the workplace, you call a union member. You call the Teamsters.
That's an excellent phrase. I love that. You know, we were in New York at the start of this tour, before the People's Tour for America began. You know, the World Trade Center buildings have now been rebuilt, all union labor, which, you know, you go back. To me, there's a major message there. You had this massive, well, this horrible tragedy.
Yes.
And who did they call?
They
to
call
rebuild
labor
it?
Labor unions. By the way, you were speaking about the arch. The arch was made by union members. United Steelworkers erected and built the arch. So that's a union-made facility.
Now we're definitely going. Can't miss that.
The thing that's neat, you've been in the arch, I'm sorry.
Oh, yes, a bunch of times.
It's like going up. I don't want to. This is what it's like. I don't mean this in any way that sounds strange, but it's like going up a zipper. You know,
yes, that actually turns. You're in a little capsule. You're in a little capsule, and the capsule takes you up. About six people are inside this capsule and takes you up to the top, and you get to look around the St. Louis metropolitan area, but it's also a little scary up there because the arch actually moves back and forth real slow, but it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing.
You know what else is scary up there? In order to look out the windows, you have to bend over this like panel that they've built, like so that you can look out the windows, and if you look down at it's just a whole pile of middle-aged women's butts.
No, I didn't look at that.
Yeah, thanks for that vision.
It looks like all those little old ladies you have bent over in the front lawn, you know, the lawn art.
Thanks
that's
that.
Just, yeah, it's exact, honest to God, I swear. Right. That would be my postcard from St. Louis if I could make one.
I have to disagree with that one.
I think you're going to get beat up before you get out of here.
Not by us.
But, you know, as the Human Rights Commission and Special Events Head here of Joint Council 13, what other parts of your job do we need to know about? Because, you know, again, I go back to what we hear in the mainstream media, generally negative, especially with Teamsters. I've had so many people over the years go, where's your baseball bat? because that's the Hollywood version of a Teamster, just somebody with a baseball bat. They're not thinking of a guy who's out there, hey, let's figure out how to build our community after a tragedy. Let's figure out how to do these big things. That's not what the media focuses on.
About 2 years ago on New Year's Eve, a freak storm came through and a tornado came through the St. Louis area and also hit the military base at Fort Leonard Wood, where we're affiliated with a group called Heroes Care, and some of the private residences of the military people who don't make a lot of money. Maybe we can organize them.
We should.
Were destroyed. Well, they put a call out to the Joint Council, and our Joint Council President, Marvin Kropp, and I talked about it, and we did not a fundraiser, but we did a furniture raiser. And the number one radio station in St. Louis, KMOX here in St. Louis, decided to get with the Joint Council, and Marvin put it together along with myself. And we asked people within 1 week to donate furniture, like slightly used or brand new furniture for the military people. Well, we envisioned maybe 4 or 5 truckloads of it. Well, USF Holland and YRC, where you used to work, came out and loaned us the equipment. The drivers, all Teamsters volunteered. It was the coldest day in St. Louis in 6 years. It was about 10 below zero outside. And all these Teamsters out there, along with the community, loaded not 5 trailers, not 7 trailers, but 13.
Wow.
And it was like Joint Council 13 tractor trailers to take to the military people down there. Well, Tom Cole out of Joint Council 16 called the Highway Patrol, which he had a friend at the Highway Patrol, probably from pulling him over all the time. But anyway.
Something about.
Yeah. Asked for the Highway Patrol to escort us down there in a convoy. And Interstate 44, where we got on the highway, all the units converged on that area. We parked in a parking lot. The Highway Patrolman said they were going to escort us, just stay in a line. They went out and pulled their cars and stopped interstate traffic. And we had a convoy going down to Fort Leonard Wood, where we took furniture down there to the military people that actually lost their furniture. And I thought it was interesting that I saw the strongest military people in the world cry and thank the Teamsters for doing stuff. And you know, we don't want publicity about it. Sorry, Teamster teeth this morning. But it makes you feel good, some of the things that we do. You know, we
do the right thing.
We do a lot of the right things. We do a drive 3 times a year with Heroes Care, where we assemble from companies that we work with and just the general public, and we put care packages together, and we send it to the military people overseas. You know, we send things from home, potato chips, shaving cream, toys so they can give to the people that they're in the areas where they're serving, and just parts of home, send them newspapers and things like that. That's part of the things that these guys do. And guess what? We don't get paid a dime to do this. It's out of the heart.
And it's stuff you've always done, because in the 20 years I was a member of the Teamsters, it's something they always did because it was the right thing, and you're right. It was not about, hey, look at me and wanting the publicity. But I'm going to tell you, we're going to give you the publicity because you deserve it. Because, you know, I think it's important that people see what labor unions do, the good in the community, the good that we do for the country. And I think it's imperative that people see that instead of what the Fox News is of the world, how they spin what labor does.
Yeah. Well, our general president has put this Human Rights Commission together, and it's not a good old boy network. It's not a good old girl network. It is a network of people that are community-minded. I also speak in schools and talk to schools about labor issues. Every school has a business class. Nobody has a labor class. Nobody talks about the other side of what you're going out into the world and work for. You know, they don't tell you about what a labor union can do for you or what has happened in the past. I know that you guys can't see me on radio, but I'm African-American. The African-American movement to be equal in this country came on the backs of labor leaders and labor operatives that got out there and helped the black community become middle class.
Well, we were in Memphis, where Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, and most people don't know he was there to support striking workers.
That's right.
And that's part of the reason that we embarked on this tour, why we think it's so important to go across the country and talk to people about our past so that we don't have to relive those things in the future.
That's true. And another thing, when you're telling young kids, if you believe in Martin Luther King's dream, he died for people to be equal in this country. I'm not asking to be ahead. I'm asking to be equal. And I enjoy going out and talking to kids in schools. I go out and talk to the older people in schools. When every time that we work a disaster, people learn more about labor unions than ever before. When Iowa had its big floods, they brought in a bunch of people to help in a warehouse. They brought 42 people in this warehouse to move the goods to the people that needed it in the community. And unfortunately, or fortunately, there were people that volunteered to help, but there were lawyers and there were people that were retired that didn't know how to move equipment and stuff. Well, the local up there, Gary Dunham, and his local out of Iowa sent me over Teamsters. And those 42 people, we bought them pizza, told them to go have a seat, and we showed them how to move the stuff with seven people. And afterwards, guy says, you know, I always fought labor unions. He says, I hated labor unions. He says, but I understand them now. He says, you guys do a lot of good. Why don't you get out and talk about it on television? We don't need to talk about it on television. We have the Rick Smith Show. We have people that actually can see us work and see what we do for a living.
That's fantastic.
We need the Rick Smith Show on a lot more stations, though.
Listen to the Rick Smith Show. Yeah. We're with Roy Gillespie. He's the head of Joint Council 13's Human Rights Commission and Special Events, also known as the Master of Disaster, for his work with disaster relief around the country and in the area. You know, I find, and you know, you talk about the people who came out during disasters and all this, I tend to find that union members across the spectrum, it doesn't matter what labor union they're in, I find that union members seem to be more community minded. They're more often your little league coaches. They're more often the ones who are going to step to the front and say, yeah, we'll do it. We'll go first.
Sure. And let's talk about disasters and union members. You got to remember, a union member that's an electrician knows everything about electricity and bringing it back together. But he also knows a little bit about other things, about how to do stuff in a correct way, what organization is like. To be a union member and to work for a company, you have a contract. So you know what you're supposed to do. So when you go into a disaster area, I don't ask the plumbers to hook up electricity. I don't ask the carpenters to drive trucks.
But it would be cheaper.
No, it wouldn't be cheaper. What was so funny in New York and Sandy, they asked for volunteers, and they couldn't get enough volunteers to help in the warehouses. Well, I called George Miranda, who was international vice president, and he had 100 Teamsters there in 2 hours and ran the warehouses to get the stuff out to the people in the New York area. I had phone calls from all over the country from Teamsters wanting to volunteer to help. I even had members from other labor unions. Do you know why? Because labor gets it. It's pure and simple. Labor gets it. They get what is hard fought for their labor history, which is very important. You can't go forward unless you know where you came from.
Sounds like you're putting organized in organized labor, and I think that's one of the big... I was at Katrina also, and I think the fact that you're also doing, human rights, when you go to these disasters, it's the people on the very bottom of the totem pole that are being affected the most by these disasters. The people who can get away do. The people who can't are just stuck there, and then their lives are horrible. The shelter I was in for Sandy had 7,800... I mean, at Sandy, Katrina had 7,800 people in it. 900 people in a bedroom, you know, and showering with fire hoses. And these are people who don't have anybody to lean on. And I think the fact that organized labor can say, hey, we make a phone call and there are 100 Teamsters there, that's the other piece that really sounds it. And the other thing you said that I thought was real important was, if you're well-trained, seven people can do the job of 42. That's a real important thing. You don't need as many people if you've got people that are really well-trained. And that's the other message that unions need to get out, is that you're not having a whole pile of people who don't know what they're doing. You've got a whole pile of people who have got apprenticeship programs and get it and get trained for it. And I think that's really, really an important fact, too. And the last thing I want to say is I really wish you could get to West Texas, because we were there and FEMA said no. FEMA said, you get no support. And we went to West Texas where the fertilizer plant blew up, and it is devastated, absolutely devastated.
Well, the part of, and I know about that situation a little bit on the FEMA situation. FEMA's thinking that they're going to put the blame on the fertilizer plant and make the fertilizer plant insurance pay for everything. Well, I found out the hard way with Sandy and Katrina something about the insurance companies. And Katrina.
Oh, please share.
Oh, and oh boy, here goes my rates going to go up after this comment. But when I worked at Katrina, if your house was flooded, they asked, they said that you didn't have flood insurance. When you were in Sandy and you got hit, if you put on the piece of paper for the insurance company saying that you were hit by Hurricane Sandy, they said you didn't have hurricane insurance. But if you got hit by a flood and told them that you had, you got hit by that, you didn't have flood insurance. So it means it's very special to me to know what you're getting into before. You need to get that insurance policy in front of you and say, let's see, do I have hurricane insurance or do I have flood insurance? Which one do I need to say that I have, because the insurance company is not your friend.
And the other part of this is, you look where we're at, where the bridge, where the truck flipped over on the bridge and melted the bridge. The company that insured the truck driver who flipped the gas truck over and blew up the bridge, $1 billion in coverage. So they're going to write that off, go, here's $1 billion here. Oh, you? You're going to cover the rest. You, the taxpayer,
sure,
you're going to cover the rest.
Sure.
And that's the part with the West situation. You know it's never going to cover all of the damage that's done, and it's going to be up to the either the people who got screwed in it getting screwed even worse, or the taxpayers picking up the bill.
And the taxpayers end up picking up the bill, but they don't pick up enough to bring back a person to hold as they were before.
Excellent.
And the insurance companies try their way to wiggle. Here goes my insurance rates. They try every which way they are to wiggle out of it. I was talking a little earlier to Tom about a situation in Sandy that a lot of people don't know. The insurance company came in real quick and said, oh, yeah, you've got $20,000 damage. Here's a check. Sign off on it right now. Well, some of those homes in there, 200 years old, and they've been passed down from generation to generation. Well, what the insurance company did is, once you signed off, you couldn't add any more to it.
Nope.
And once you start to rebuild, the city or the township that you're in or the county says, oh, wait a minute. Yes, you do have drywall that's messed up to replace, but because of this build, you have to go through new electrical codes, you have to go new building codes and stuff, and that $20,000 the insurance company pays you and you get out of there with, now it's going to cost you $150,000. That's another part where unions come in. If you have the right person who can come in and says, okay, we know that you need GIF, we need this, and this, that's an expertise that you know. So when you go to the insurance company before your final settlement, you can say, I've got it in my hand, and this is what I need to pay.
So let me ask you a last question I've got for you, Roy. You know, in looking at all of this and the experience and the expertise that you have, you know, how did you get involved in this? I mean, you started off your Teamster like me. I was just a dumb truck driver driving down the road. How did you get involved in this?
Always had a flair for community service and helping people out, because people have helped me out in the past. I grew up, I was born and raised in Gary, Indiana. My mother and father were in iron and steel. My mother stayed at home and ironed while my dad worked in the steel mill. We were a middle-class, one-paycheck family. One-paycheck family.
How'd that
class
happen?
That was back in the 50s. One paycheck. You know, and the thing that I thought rounded me out well or bad, whichever way, is when you went to school, Dad was a United Steel worker. Mom was at home. You messed up in school. Mom came with that raggedy house coat and beat your butt all the way home. And then she said those horrible words to you. Wait till your dad gets home. And then after that, the grandparents beat on you. And then the neighbors are watching you. And you're going, like, I don't need this. I better act right and do the right thing. I remember growing up as and not knowing anything about unions as a child. But then I look back, the United Steelworkers in Gary, Indiana, at Christmas time, they came around and dressed up in the top hats and different clothing, the bow ties, and they sing Christmas carols. The United Steelworkers, we used to have Christmas parties for all the kids and stuff. And it was a one paycheck, middle class home with two cars. And mom was there to help us with the homework. Dad was there to help us with the homework. And it took one person to make life easy for you compared to one person not there at all or two people out there and raising themselves. And I don't remember any time in life that I had to look for a parent. I was blessed. I was blessed. And in the Teamsters Union, it's like that too. Your family. There is not a time that I have asked this joint council president, Marvin, I've called him at time, or even to Mr. Hoffa's office, and asked the international for help. And they never turned me down, especially on a disaster. Anytime that I go into an area for a disaster, or on the phone with a disaster, I'll call the local and I'll ask for help. It's there. They're willing to help. And that's what part of being a union is about, is the brotherhood, and the sisterhood, too. So that's what we're about.
Roy, it was great talking with you. I appreciate your story.
Thank you, and have fun down at the Arch. It's well, union made.
Well, I can't wait to see it. Roy Gillespie, the master of disaster. Head of Joint Council 13's Human Rights Commission and special events as well.
I got a great idea.
Hit me.
We've got to have some sort of a mud wrestling championship, and we'll put our master of disaster up against those masters of disaster in the state houses.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
What do you give a guy who has everything?
Labor history, of course.
And where can you get a great dose of labor history?
Right here, weeknights from 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show.
From New York City factories to West Virginia coal mines to Oregon loading docks to Toledo glass factories, you'll hear all the stories right here, right up until the new year.
And then we'll be back with all new shows here on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
On December 28, 1970, President Richard Nixon signed the Occupational Safety and Health Act into law. Thanks to strong lobbying efforts by union leaders over many years, this safety bill of rights established for the first time a comprehensive national policy to protect workers' health and safety. Effective April 28, 1971, employers were required to provide a workplace free of known hazards that caused or were likely to cause serious physical injury or death. Prior to the passage of OSHA, work-related injuries and deaths were extremely high. The 1920s saw reports of 20,000 workers killed on the job and more than 2.5 million injured per year. That number remained until the 1960s when work-related deaths dropped to 14,000 per year, but injuries increased by 20%. Today, thanks to OSHA, protections on-the-job injuries have fallen 40% and on-the-job deaths have been reduced by 60% pre-OSHA. OSHA is considered the first piece of legislation allowing the government to inspect and hold employers accountable for dangerous and physically harmful working conditions. OSHA has three branches, an enforcement branch, a research branch, and a review branch. Since its passage, OSHA has allowed for greater visibility and oversight in conditions on the job, prioritizing efforts to prevent accidents, control health hazards, and ensure workers go home as safe and as healthy as when they arrived on the job. While OSHA is a step in the right direction, there is still considerable work to be done, and only through the eyes and voices of working people with the help of their unions will tomorrow be a safer day. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therichsmithshow.com.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. Welcome to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. We are in Detroit, Michigan, the People's Tour for America on the road here in the historic Teamster building that, well, James R. Hoffa, first place right here, history, right here. And this is the reason we went on this tour, to be in places like this, to talk about the history of workers across this country. And here in Detroit, we're going to talk with Mike Kerwin. He's the labor historian for the Michigan Labor History Society, also a retired UAW member from the West Side Local 174. That was Walter Reuther's home local, being in Jimmy Hoffa's home local, talking to a guy from Walter Reuther's home local. That's the reason for this tour, Mike. Thanks for taking time for us.
We're homies.
Yeah, you know, I look at, you know, I drive around Detroit and you think about the history of the struggle of building that middle class that my grandparents' generation fought, bled, and died for. And, you know, the sad reality is we're seeing it going away.
You drive around Detroit now, if you were here 50, 60 years ago, it's enough to break your heart. In the 50s, 60s, 70s, Detroit was loaded with auto assembly plants, parts plants, machine plants, tool and die plants, hundreds and hundreds of places to work. Now it's down to maybe a dozen altogether.
Yeah, it's sad stuff. And, you know, I want to go back to that period after World War II, because my grandfather told me tons of stories, you know, about fighting for that middle class, because, you know, we didn't always have that. And a lot of people I talk to today think that the things that we have, the 8-hour day, the 40-hour work week, weekends, all of those things are given to us by a benevolent corporation. And, you know, all these robber barons that we see, the series, The Men Who Built America, you know, they were benevolent and they were, you know, well, they just wanted the best for people.
Anything that workers get, they have to get it by the use of power. And that's where the union comes in. And it worked in the generation right after the war. Here in Detroit, it worked all across the country. And then somehow it sort of fell apart.
You know, for those of us who don't know Detroit's labor history, which is a rich and bloody history, you know, walk us through some of the key events that everyone should know about Detroit. In your mind, what's the big one?
Well, the auto industry is the big story, but you got to go back into the 19th century. Detroit at that time was a medium-sized manufacturing city. There was money here because the moguls who made money from the lumber camps up north in Michigan, it all came down here, and they used that to establish shipbuilding and ironworking and wagon making and a lot of stuff like that. There was a small but vibrant labor movement here in the 19th century. The Knights of Labor were here, and eventually the American Federation of Labor was here. They made some good moves. But around the turn of the century, the bosses got together when the auto industry started coming together, and they clamped down, and they said, we're going to make Detroit the open shop city of America, which means non-union. And there were remnants of the AFL left through the 19-aughts and 10s and 20s, but it was no longer a strong union town. And then the Depression came, and eventually the CIO, and that's when we really became a strong union town.
Now, you go back to that period that you talked about there where the unions had been crushed. What were conditions like here? I know you weren't around then, but I'm sure you've studied that period, because I want people to understand, you know, I want our listeners to know that, you know, things were really bad before unions.
They were bad and they were good too. Detroit was known to be a fairly good place to work. Let me tell you a story that Frank Kelly told us. Frank Kelly later was an attorney, and he became Michigan's attorney general through the 1960s and 70s. He held the job so long they called him the eternal general. But his grandfather came here from Ireland. He went to Corktown. He got a job in a foundry, and in that foundry he worked and supported his wife and his 7 kids. But it was dangerous work. And one day he got careless with a machine malfunctioned, and he got struck in the stomach by the rod that he was holding, and it gave him severe injuries. He was afraid to tell the bosses that he was hurt, so he came to work, and on the third day he just dropped dead and died. Well, his pay at that time, and this was just around the turn of the century, was $2 a day. The family was without income, and the boss knew about it. So the boss at this foundry said to his sons, "We'll take two of you on to replace your father. He was making $2 a day. Each one of you will make $1 a day, so your family income will be the same." Now, was that benevolent or was that cruel? I don't know. But that's one of the things that happened.
And what if he didn't have sons?
Who knows?
You know, what happens to the people? You know, we've talked to the mine workers who go back, you know, through the company towns, and if the father died and there were no sons to take on, the family was to the streets, because, you know, the company housing, you're not working in the mines, you're not living in the company house. So I would only assume that to the street you would go.
I think unless they'd approached the company would have written them off and forgotten about them. Yeah. But that's how it was like in the late 19th century, early 20th century. In the early auto industry, conditions really were bad. Henry Ford invented the assembly line. He found out that if you make things quicker, you can make them cheaper, that if you drive your workers, if you break down the work so that it's much simpler, and each worker, instead of spending 5 minutes to complete his job, does two of them in a minute, or even faster than that, if you work out the economic details, the company makes a lot of money, and they speed up the workers. If you're production,
and they take away the skill of doing that.
Oh, yes.
that skill.
And to some extent, the worker becomes just a mere automaton, and the skilled worker who in the 19th century might have been making the production is reduced to nothing.
Yeah. You know, we were in Kansas City, and we were at the UAW local there, the first Ford local in the country, is what they told us. And, you know, the guy told us a story about Henry Ford, because the mainstream media loves to say Henry Ford gave, you know, gave his workers a $5 day.
And he did.
But according to them, and maybe you can speak to this, according to them, you had, in order to get that, because they claim not many people did, you had to achieve a certain production level. You had to have a certain lifestyle, because they came into your home and made sure that you were operating in your family in a certain way. The wives had to take classes on being homemakers. And it was really, to me, you know, it sounded very patriarchal.
It was worse than patriarchal, and many of those early workers were immigrants from European countries, especially from the south of Europe. There were a lot of Greeks there, there were Italians, there were Poles in the Ford shop and in the other shops. And when they came in, they had to learn the language, and the way Henry Ford wanted to do it, they would learn the language his way. They would learn the principles of American citizenship his way, which was you do what the foreman says. It was a hard time. I've been to Kansas City. There's a labor history museum there, and there's a big exhibit in the sidewalk, and the UAW local is part of that exhibit. They must be a pretty good local.
Yeah, we had a great time when we were in Kansas City, and lots of interesting stories. And, of course, if you missed any portion of our tour, the People's Tour for America, you can check out the website, peoplestourforamerica.com, and hear the interviews we did in Kansas City. You know, Mike, you know, as we go through and we think about the past, you know, I like to tie things into the future. And where we're heading, because, you know, the battles my grandparents fought, I fear my kids are going to have to fight for their children in the coming years. And you go back and you think of some of the history. You know, you go back, let's say, you know, the fights that went on in the auto industry. What was life like in the factories then, and how did they get better by organizing?
Well, life in the factories could vary a lot depending on what kind of a product you were making. I came out of a small production shop local. We were an amalgamated local. We had 90 different plants, 27,000 members, making all different kinds of things. Some of that work could be quite good work and interesting work. Others could be totally boring, and management could be totally dictatorial, and your life could be miserable. And you had no recourse. If you complained in a shop that had that kind of an attitude, you were out the door. And especially during the Depression, you know, if there was even a slight hint that you might be unhappy, the foreman would take you to the window and point out on the street and says, "There's 100 guys out there waiting for a job. It could be your job unless you do what I tell you."
Yeah, we were in Kansas City, and they showed us the old factory site where there was a park where, you know, there were hundreds of people waiting for someone to get fired so that they could take their position. And you bring that to today. You know, with the high unemployment, the, you know, 15 million some odd people looking for a job, I think employers are playing that same game, only in a different way.
It is in a different way, but yeah, the same game goes on, and it's not just in the auto industry; it's in the entire economy of the United States. the employers like to see lots of people looking for jobs.
Yep.
You know, there's a quote from Adam Smith that I like to say. And he was an economic philosopher in Scotland in the late 18th century. He
wrote his right wing just loves the quote.
He's
the right wing darling.
He's the author of their economic theory. And he said in his book, The Wealth of Nations, if one master seeks labor and two hands are available, master was the word for employer, hand was the word for worker. If one master seeks and two hands are available, the price of labor will go down. If two masters seek labor and one hand is available, the price of labor will go up. So the masters, the current masters who are the employers, corporation heads, always want to see a pool of unemployed hands out there so that if they hire, they can hire them at a lower rate.
Yeah, thus these insane free trade agreements, thus the fetish with inflation over full employment with the Federal Reserve. You know, it's to me, full employment policies are something we should be going full forward towards instead of austerity and cut, and punish. Because as you've pointed out, you know, wages have gone down because of that. Because we have so many unemployed, and you know, we point back to the Emmanuel Saez study from Cal Berkeley, who said, you know, 2010, 93% of all new income went to the top 1% because you had all of these unemployed. And in 2011, 121% of the new income went to that top 1%, and it goes exactly to what you're saying.
It's a free market, selfish capitalist system, and labor is not directing its attack against the malfeasances of that system. Labor needs to focus more intently on what the so-called capitalist system does and how this hurts people and what we can do to change it.
So take me back to the Depression, because to me, 2008, we were on the cusp of a depression. Had it not been for Social Security, unemployment, food stamps, we would have been right full-lorn into depression. Take me back to that period where you go, okay, we're in a depression, but workers are organizing, saying, you know what? We can't feed ourselves. We can't eat. We don't have these programs. We want some of the profits. Take me back to that.
Well, the Depression went on for many, many years. And for the people who were out of jobs, and that was a huge portion of the population, it was like hell on earth. Your money stopped coming in, and except for what private charity could do or what meager resources your city could put together, there was no money to buy any food for the kids. No money to pay the rent, and you were facing being thrown out of your house. It went on from 1929 into 1935, getting worse and worse. The labor movement that existed at that time, the American Federation of Labor, found its hands tied. They were firmly tied to the principle that unions should be craft-based, so that if you had a union in an auto shop, you'd have one for the machinists, one for the tool makers, one for the die makers, one for the electricians, one for the carpenters, another half dozen skilled trades, and then two-thirds of the workforce wouldn't even be included because they weren't skilled. They were semi-skilled or unskilled, and so nothing was happening. And that's when this remarkable guy, John L. Lewis, came along, the head of the mine workers. You know from where you guys come from how the mines worked. And he had his good points and he had his bad points, but he had this idea in the mid-1930s that the answer to labor's problems was an industrial union, which meant that all the people who worked in a particular factory or a mine would belong to one union altogether. And that went against the American Federation of Labor. They threw him out. So he formed what they first called the Committee for Industrial Organization, and then they changed it over to what it has been ever since, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And they set out with the miners' union being the main support, because that was an existing union, to help organize the steel industry, the auto industry, the electrical industry, all of the other major industries that were unorganized in this country. And that all happened 1935, 1936, 1937, when the Depression was still going on full strength. We had a very important other factor, though, and that was some favorable political conditions. You had Franklin Roosevelt in the White House, who was an experimenter. Whether he had a philosophy or not, he was willing to try, and he wanted to help people. And the New Deal came along. They put in all kinds of programs. They passed laws. Some worked, some didn't. They passed the Wagner Act, which made it federal law that our workers had a right to belong to a union, and workers began to hold elections and organize unions. And in the auto industry, it all came to a head in General Motors in the late December of 1936, when the people just were fed up. They'd had so much of pushing, so much of uncertainty, so much of speed up, of being required to make more production this week than we had to make last week, that they just sat down in the plants. They'd seen sit-down strikes in Akron, Ohio, where the rubber workers sat down. There were a scattering of union organizers in the plants, and they just sat down in the General Motors plants in Flint. They sat down elsewhere, in Cleveland, in Atlanta, Georgia, in Kansas City, all around Michigan, in Detroit. But the strike really focused in Flint, and it went on for 41 days. And General Motors was tearing their hair out, and they knew that for the past 100 years, if you had a strike in your town, in your factory, you could call on the governor of the state, and the governor would send in the militia to break the strike. Well, guess what? 2 days after the strike started, the new governor of Michigan, who had been elected the November before, he took office on January 1st. So the strike was already in progress. It was the same year as a Roosevelt landslide nationally. And Frank Murphy was the Democratic governor of Michigan. He had a philosophy that workers, people needed to get a fair shake. When General Motors came to him and said, we want you to bring the militia, the Michigan National Guard to Flint, he said, okay, I will. We said, we want you to get the workers out of the plants. He said, we will preserve order. There will be no violence. And they went bonkers because they wanted to use the soldiers to break the strike. And it didn't happen. And because of that, and because of the strong influence of John Lewis and the moral support from Washington, after 41 days, they got a contract with General Motors. And it was a one-page contract. It said the workers' union, the UAW, is recognized as the official bargaining agency for them in the General Motors plants where we have had these strikes, and we will sit down later and work out some of the details on wages, hours, and working conditions. And that's where it started, and it just took off from there.
And that is so important because, you know, as we found in other places like Cripple Creek, Colorado, where the power of the gun stayed neutral and didn't break down workers' conditions and didn't destroy the right to organizing, things got better for everybody. And, you know, as history goes on, everybody's lives got better.
That's right. But the depression lingered. It got better. It got worse. It still was there until the economy began gearing up for World War II, and we got into the war in 1941, and lots of things were going on, but other things were frozen. Labor developments were kind of put on hold until the war was over.
Right.
So in 1945, you had a situation now, workers were looking and saying, will we begin to share, get a fair share of the great productivity that this country has shown during the war, or are they going to push us back into the gutter where we were before the Union? And if they looked at what happened after the previous war, the World War I, when it was over in 1918, the companies clamped down on the unions. There was a big steel strike that was broken. There were coal strikes that were broken. There was the armies and navies and air forces fighting in West Virginia.
We were there.
Labor was crushed after World War I. It didn't happen after World War II. And there were a number of reasons why that was. But certainly the fact that we had a new breath of fresh air with the labor movement, and let's say the AFL saw what the CIO was doing starting in 1935, and they started doing likewise, so they began to prosper too. There was a stronger labor movement. You had, although Roosevelt was gone, you had Truman, who carried on his philosophy of using government to help all the people. And you had a feeling among the workers that it's up to us, we have to support whatever's there for us, so we have to use our power to make things better. And that combination of factors led through the 1940s and into the 50s. We got good wage increases. We got some control over the speed up. We built the grievance procedures so that it really worked in the plant. We established the principle of seniority so that the boss couldn't play favorites, that if you had worked in the place, you had some rights for your vacation selection. You had rights when a promotion came up that you could bid for that, and your seniority would give you some help on it. These are the things that happened in the plants and made it more possible to get these improvements. And, of course, we began to get industrially company-funded pensions. Defined benefit pensions.
Which they're stealing, and which they've been stealing and destroying for the last 30 years.
They're destroying it now. And we began to get company-financed health care, which was a good step in the right direction. All those things came together, and workers' standard of living really rose quite substantially.
Because as their productivity went up, their wages went up.
Of course.
And you look at the graphs of productivity and wage increases from the end of World War II up until that guy took office in 1981. It went right. They were together all the way up. Productivity went up. Wages went up. As soon as Reagan took office, that decoupling happened. And productivity has skyrocketed. Wages have actually declined since then.
Yeah, and that's a tragedy. And labor should not have allowed that to happen. How preventing it to happen would have taken place, you can't guess anymore. You know, the what-ifs don't really matter. What really is important is how do you tackle it now?
Right.
And to me, one thing that I think labor's got to take a hard, hard look at, during the Depression, during the war, the years after the war, labor found it had a good friend in the Democratic Party. In Michigan, nationally. Franklin Roosevelt, nationally. Harry Truman, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, were presidents who worked for workers. In Michigan, Michigan was one of the most rock-ribbed Republican states for 100 years. But since the war, we had Governor G. Menon Williams here for 12 years, and the state government was vacillating between being pro-worker and pro-corporation. Right now, we're in a bad state in that regard.
Horrible.
But we had a good friend in the Democratic Party. Starting before even Ronald Reagan time, that began to change. And we've had, and especially now you can see it with Bill Clinton, who did some good things. But he helped establish something called the New Democrats. And they were very much in the pocket of Wall Street. And they've been that way ever since. And the National Democratic Party is as good a friend to Wall Street as it is to labor. And that ain't good enough.
I'm with you. Let me ask you the last question I've got for you, Mike. You know, as we have our time here in Detroit, you know, what one thing do you want, when people think of Detroit, what should they think of?
When they think of Detroit?
When it comes to labor history, what's the one thing that, you know, I'm trying to get some folks to say, okay, you know, I learned something today. You know, what's that one thing you'd want them to take away?
That if you've got jobs, you have to watch out for them. And we had hundreds, as I told you, tool and die shops here, just within the boundaries of the city of Detroit. We had scores of machine shops and parts plants. We had probably a dozen or more auto assembly plants where people could go to work, and they were all feeding on each other and with each other. Well, for a variety of reasons, the corporations decided they would start decentralizing and building factories not in Detroit but in the suburbs or in other parts of the country. And, of course, since NAFTA, or even before that, since Ronald Reagan, around the world. And we sat by, we labor, the people of Detroit, the politicians, and watched these plants go and wrung our hands. And it seems to me more could have been done to encourage the employers to stay here, to make city government work so that it was friendly and helpful to established companies and to new ones coming in. To get a permit to do anything in a business way in Detroit has been like having a tooth excavated for 20 or 30 years. And every mayor who comes in says, I'm going to fix that. And every mayor who comes in doesn't fix it. So that if a company wants to come and set up a shop here, they've got to get a permit for this. They've got to get a permit for that. They go around the bend. Every time they got to talk to somebody else, it takes time, it takes time, it takes time, and they give up. And we've now got, an emergency manager in Detroit. We may or may not have a bankruptcy in Detroit. But among other things, There has to be an establishment in Detroit. It's got to be labor, but it's got to be others. It's got to be the companies. It's got even to be the financial people who would look at the city and say, we have an obligation to bring to make Detroit like it was before. There's plenty of room for jobs here, and we need to make it happen. And it needs to, people need to get together on that.
I'm with you. Mike Kerwin, we appreciate the time. Labor historian for the Michigan Labor History Society, also a retired UAW member. From the historic Walter Reuther local, Westside Local 174. Mike, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. I'm glad to have the chance to do it.
Quick break, right back from Detroit. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You know they're going to push us around, Mr. Pep and Dig and Mr. Hardy can haul it, because I'm going to leave it in the ground. Mr. Taft can dig and Mr. Harley can haul and Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. It's gonna take a lot of longer than 80 short days for this miner to cool on down. Mr. Taft can dig and Mr. Harley can haul it.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history. Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith.
We need to stand united, undivided, we shall never fall. Remember all, we need to trust in and then forever call our brothers and our sisters, and are you and I aware? You and I both know that we can't rely.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at TheRickSmithShow.com or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. You know, Pat, in doing our research coming into St. Louis, I found out a couple interesting facts. You know, St. Louis was the place where they came up with the union label concept.
Really?
It was the cigar makers who put the cigar makers logo on the box so that you as a union member could know that, you know, that cigar was union made.
Huh. Well, that's a great thing.
And you know,
unfortunately, you can't find it bug anywhere near often enough.
Well, anything that the Rick Smith Show's name is on, there's a bug attached to it. In fact, our great tour T-shirts, if you want one of those, well, we can figure out a way of getting those as well. They'll be on sale after the tour is over. I'm sitting here with Ed Finkelstein. He's the publisher of the St. Louis Southern Illinois Labor Tribune, labortribune.com, the website. He is the man who... Well, he's the guy who covers labor here in the area. Ed, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to be with you, Rick. My pleasure.
You know, in your years of covering labor events, you know, have you, in looking at the mainstream media, have you seen a bias against labor? Because when I was a kid growing up, I delivered both the Cleveland Press and the Cleveland Plain Dealer. The Cleveland Press actually had a labor page with labor reporters. This is going back, you know, a number of years, but there was actually a labor page in one of the papers.
Well, and there used to be labor papers in all the major cities, including St. Louis, had some great labor reporters. They're just gone by the wayside. Nobody covers labor anymore, except the exception. If there's a strike, if there's a problem, then that makes news. And news today is all an exception. What's going on? You know, you don't hear about airlines flying millions of miles with no problem, but have one crash and you got a disaster and you got front page news every place across the country. The same thing with labor unions. It's the exception that makes the rule. Nobody talks about the things that the Teamsters were just talking about, how much they do in the way of positive things in the neighborhoods, in the community. The Labor Tribune becomes the voice of the AFL-CIO, the Teamsters, the UAW in this community to tell the community what's happening in the labor movement, not only the things that are critical, strikes, things that are the issues that people are concerned about, but also the community stuff that we do. It's a phenomenal organization, the unions, that do work not only for their members, but in the community. And we help tell that story. That's
but, you know, what's always amazing to me is, you know, and I'm one of the people out there tooting the horn of labor when they do the things that they do without asking any credit for it. You know, as we were talking about with Roy, you know, all of the work that the Teamsters do that I'm sure very few people know about. You know, I remember when Katrina happened, the local I was a member of sent their own truck down numerous times with you know, loaded supplies from churches. And never was there any credit given. In fact, when the local media would take a picture of it, they would just show the open doors of the back of the truck. But they didn't want any of that. And I'm of the mindset that, you know, someone's got to toot their horn, so it's got to be people like you and me.
Right. And we say that all the time. But the problem is the labor movement's its own worst enemy in that way. As Roy said, nobody toots their own horn. They don't want to pat themselves on the back. They deserve it, but they don't want to do it because it's what they do normally. When there's a disaster, when there's a need, they just step up and do it because they're your neighbors. They're your friends. They're people that live in the community and want to do what's the right thing. And so they don't take any credit for it. And that's a shame because people would have a different image of what unions are all about. You hear all the negative stereotypes that Fox News and the radical right has been promoting for years. It sinks in. People start believing that BS.
Because you're beaten with it daily.
Absolutely. And we don't get out and tell our story enough. For example, in St. Louis, right now we have a campaign that we started with the St. Louis Labor Council called Five for the Fight. It's a campaign that originally raised some money for a big strike that was at McDonnell Douglas many, many years ago, now Boeing. That campaign's continued on, and we've raised close to $750,000 for union families that are out of work who need help to buy medicine, to pay rent, to go to the doctor. And it's union members just stepping up making donations every week. We run a big page of people that have donated. That's only one example of hundreds of examples at Christmas time, at a disaster, if there's a need. There's probably not a church or a synagogue in this community at one time or another has not had help from a labor union when they had a crisis. And so the unions do a lot of good work in the community. In addition to fighting for wages and benefits for their own members, that people just never realize. And another important factor people don't realize is that as the wages of union members continue to grow, so did the wages of non-union members. Because companies that want to keep good employees know that if they've got a union company that's a competitor, they're going to have to pay close to those wages. In fact, some of them pay even a little bit more because they don't give the same benefits.
Right.
So they pay a little bit more to keep their good people from going over to the union place. And so the unions raise wages and benefits for everybody, even if you're not union. People don't understand it. They're going to start realizing it now as the economy gets worse, tightens up more. Everybody's beating wages down. Unions are giving up issues, giving up on benefits many times to help the company stay alive. But as their wages start to stagnate, you're going to see the other wages in throughout the economy stagnate as well.
Yeah, I think we've been seeing that at, you know, a number of places that have had major concessions and, you know, basically kicking people to the curb, like the folks we met out in Portland, the ILWU workers who have been locked out since May, I guess it's been. And again, if you want to take a look at the ILWU lockout, we've got a link at the People's Tour for America. I ask folks to sign the petition to get Congress and the president to weigh in and get those guys back to work, get the people back to the table. It's one of those things that I think is vitally important. But, you know, you look at these lockouts, you look at all of these concessionary contracts, all of this stuff that's being imposed on workers, and, you know, I say the only reason we're hearing about it is because those folks have contracts. Those people have rights. If they didn't have those contracts, we'd never hear about it. It would just happen.
Right. But it also brings up an important point. When there is a crisis in the community or in a company, if you sit down with the unions, they're willing, with the rank and file and leadership, they're willing to make those concessions because they know it's important. We all understand that if a company doesn't thrive, it can't negotiate a contract. And so I can't tell you.
So the frame of unions put people out of business, you know?
It's nonsense, absolute nonsense. Unions work with their companies all the time to try to keep them in business. And I can tell you in this town alone, there have been thousands and thousands of work rule changes just in the building trades over the years to make their companies competitive with non-union and to help local contractors win jobs. It's a misnomer that unions put companies out of business. Now, there have been occasions where that's happened because the company was so outrageous and was making such incredible demands that it's the rank and file that said no.
Yes.
It's not necessarily the leadership that says we're going to put a company out of business. The unions are the last bastion, I think, of real democracy in this country because it is the rank and file that votes on everything. And so where you see a company going out of business, it's because the rank and file said we've had it. We're not going to take it anymore, and we're going to walk away from it.
Or the companies just decided that it was better to take our money and run. I look at the Hostess
right.
situation where they blamed it on the workers, but you're talking almost a generation of horrible mismanagement and lack of investment in product and in facility that caused the hostess situation. But you look at that, and the right has grasped on it. Well, it was those bakery workers. Right. And we did a little traveling around St. Louis here, and there are a lot of factories and a lot of trucking companies that are out of business. And, you know, I hear people say, well, it was just those unions who did that. And you go, no, it's much more complex than just a guy wanting to make a decent wage. I just had a conversation the other morning with a gentleman, told me the steel mills were out of business because those workers wanted a living wage with vacations.
Well, as I said, it's absolute nonsense. And you will have company owners that will admit that they've made bad decisions. I mean, the General Motors situation, they made a lot of bad decisions that resulted in that company in the country. And where you have really honest employers, they'll tell you that some bad decisions were made by management. The guy in the field, he's doing his job. He's working along. He's making the company money. But if the company misinvests it, spends it on huge salaries. When a company CEO makes 500 and 600 times more than the average worker when it used to be 20 to 30, I don't begrudge any CEO making a good salary. CEOs work hard. I mean, I get to see a CEO who doesn't take home a briefcase every night because he's got work to do. But the reality is, those disparities would be great. That it's outrageous and it's uncalled for. And the guy in on the production line, he's trying to do his job.
I don't care how good of a CEO the guy at McDonald's is. I'm sorry. I don't care how good he is, how long he works, how what he does. He is not worth a million hours a year.
You know, the thing that I've been thinking of listening to you two guys talk, and I think the fact that you're both in the media is really important because you are both trying to get the message out. But the thing that I'm thinking while you're talking is the young man who saw the person in Boston leave the backpack. And this young man who, after he's had his legs blown off when the backpack exploded at the Boston Marathon, has the presence of mind to tell what he saw, and then they get an outdoor camera that shows who dropped the backpack. And he worked at McDonald's. And then in his next interview, he begged for the health care necessary. That wouldn't have happened if he'd had a union job. He wouldn't have been on nationwide TV begging not to be thrown out of that hospital after he had his legs blown off in a national disaster, you know?
Well, what's happening with health care in this country is a disaster in itself. And we ought to be ashamed as a nation for the wealthiest nation in the world to be, what, 43rd in health care around the world is ludicrous, absolutely ludicrous. And for companies to say, I can't afford to do health care when they pay their CEO 600 times more than the average worker, that's nonsense as well. And part of it's just pure greed. It's pure greed on the part of CEOs to decide they deserve it.
Do you think that has to do with the fact that there's no one advocating for the other side? And I know across the country right now there's a number of groups, Raise Up America and Fast Food Forward, and a lot of these groups are saying, you know what, we need to make these fast food jobs, these retail jobs, the middle class of the next generation, as my grandparents did with the factories and the mills and truck driving and all of those things, so that you don't have to beg for health care and that you don't have to worry if your family's going to be sick. Do you think that's where we need to be organizing next?
I hope that that's indicative of a grassroots effort to reinvigorate American workers as to what's right and what they need, and they've got a right to stand up for themselves. You know, there's the movie Newsroom, was that? I forgot the name of the movie, that where the newscaster puts his head out the window and says, I've had it, I'm fed up, I'm not going to take it anymore. And people start listening to that. We haven't hit bottom yet, unfortunately. I think at some point in time, and not in the too distant future, workers are going to finally say, I've had it, I'm not going to take it anymore, and they're going to start standing up and being more militant. And you're seeing it with young workers now in the fast food industry, in the restaurant industry. To have to rely on tips in the restaurant industry, for example, to make a fair living is ridiculous. You ought to be paying a fair wage. And there's a New York restaurant I just read recently where they now are paying health care benefits and a decent wage and have a sign that we don't allow tipping. I think that's the direction everybody ought to go. Workers put in a fair day's work for a fair day's pay. They ought to be paid properly.
I'm with you. Ed Finkelstein, publisher of the St. Louis and Southern Illinois Labor Tribune, labortribune.com, the website. How'd you get started into all this?
I started off as the gopher when I was about 12 years old during the summer, Hey, kid, go for the coffee. Hey, kid, go for the donuts. And one of the reporters asked me to write a story. It was an obituary of some labor leader that died. And I said, I've never written a story. He said, well, try it. And he said, I'll help you. And so I read obituaries for about a week to see how obituaries were staggered. And I wrote the story. I think he rewrote the whole thing. I may have two original words in there. But he put my byline on the story. And the minute I saw my name in print, I could not believe that the words that I had written appeared in a newspaper. It was in the Labor Tribune. And so that determined my going off to college to become a journalism major and getting into the business. Spent 4 years in the Air Force in public relations, came back out and went to work for the Labor Tribune. And in the mid-70s, I bought the paper out, and it was one of my goals was to own that newspaper because I believed in what it was doing. It was fighting for working people. It was fighting for the underdog. And it was fighting for what's right and fair and honest in this society. And not enough people were fighting, giving that fight a voice. And the Labor Tribune's there to give that fight a voice. And I'm very proud of the fact that we've won national awards for the kind of reporting that we have. We have professional journalists on staff. We cover the labor movement like a blanket. Even non-subscribers, if they've got a problem, we're fighting for them. And we're proud of what we do.
What's your most memorable moment in all the years you've been doing this? What's that one thing you go, yeah, this is why I do it? Or are there so many that
Well, there are a lot, but I think it was the 1978 battle over the phony Right to Work campaign. We created the slogan, Right to Work's a ripoff, that's become a phrase that's being used all over the country now that explains what this phony Right to Work is. And it became a leap-off point for people to say, what's the ripoff all about? And then you get a chance to really tell people that it has nothing to do with Right to Work. It has to do with Right to Work for Less, putting workers down. And I think that's probably one of my most memorable points in my career, although there have been a lot. It's been a lot of fun, and it'll continue to be a lot of fun.
You know, I look back at the Right to Work thing, and I've always said that labor should reclaim that. And say, you're right, we should have the right to work. That means there should be a full employment policies, and we should have labor laws that benefit workers instead of what we've seen them turn into. Because originally, it was right to work was a labor phrase. We want the right to a job.
Right. Well, and they've turned the Republicans, at least the radical Republicans, I can't say all because we've got some good Republican friends that support working people, but the radical right has taken a course over the past 10, 15 years. They have planned this assault on unions because it's the unions that have been the counterbalance to management. And it's only been the unions that have been the main counterbalance to poor management, greedy management. And so they decided they wanted to destroy the unions. And they started off very methodically getting involved in state legislatures, gerrymandering districts, reelecting people, getting people elected to office. And then starting, as you see now, through this group called ALEC, this national campaign where the same laws are being proposed in states across the country that have been proposed by this radical group called ALEC.
But they're not new.
Oh, they're not new.
They started in 1973.
Exactly. They're organized.
And they're funded.
They're funded. You took the words out of my mouth.
Hugely funded.
Exactly.
I mean, this is what the billionaire class, the robber barons of this generation, this is what they've done, and it's all methodically plotted out because, you know, I wanted to go back, and you said 1978 you came up with Right to Work's a ripoff. 1978. A lot of our listeners probably weren't even born then, but yet this issue is back time and time and time again. And for our listeners in central Pennsylvania, if you think that it's not here in our, it's not in Pennsylvania, it's always there.
Right. And one of the sad things that's happening today, and part of the reason the labor movement's in a decline, is not only this assault, this deliberate assault, but our own members, our younger members, have taken everything for granted. I mean, they weren't around in 1978, the average worker today, when we fought that campaign. If you do a survey of union members right now, you would find that a majority of them would probably support Right to Work because they don't understand it. Right. They don't understand how it's going to affect them. And so younger workers have taken a lot for granted that their parents and grandparents fought on the picket line, had to eat peanut butter and jelly three times a day because they didn't have any food, that went without medicine so their kids could have clothes. They hadn't gone through that. And so they never had an empty belly to understand what it means to be a union member and why the unions are strong. And so our younger members don't appreciate that, and they take it for granted. And when it doesn't happen, they're really ticked off. Well, that's part of what this movement is all about, that's taken advantage of that feeling.
And they've eviscerated any labor education from the schools, you know, as we're going around the country and we're learning. You know, I like to think I know, have a little bit of knowledge in labor history. We're learning things every day. And the reality is, you know, the vast majority of people don't know that the 8-hour day, safety on the job, people literally died for
kindergartens,
them.
I mean, basic education, all of that came from the labor safety laws, minimum wage. I mean, the average union member makes much more than a union wage, but the reality is we fight like hell to improve the minimum wage. So all of these things are a result of the labor movement, and the companies who are trying to destroy us realize that. And so they've decided that the way to bring everything down is to destroy the unions so there's no voice for working people, and then they'll have their way with us any way they see fit.
And there's no one to say when a CEO of McDonald's makes a million hours a year, a million hours. Think about that.
Well, the top 10 on the Forbes list make the same as every fast food worker in the country.
Yeah, it's a crying shame. It's a disaster, and it's immoral. I mean, we have a new group here called the Clergy Labor Alliance, where clergy are now getting behind the labor movement because what's happening to the working class, not only union members but all workers, is literally immoral. And they're starting to stand up and speak out that says, we can't take this anymore. We're going to do something about it. But until people get registered and until people vote and until we get off our duffs and go to the polls, take to the streets, and make those changes, it's going to continue to get worse. And my hope is that it's not that much worse, that people finally said, I've had it, I'm not going to take it anymore, I'm going to do something about it. And do something about it is to get registered, vote, and get out in the streets and let people know we're upset, we're not going to take it anymore.
Now, people can subscribe to your paper that may be anywhere in the country, right, and learn some labor news?
Yes, absolutely. They can they go to the website, www.labortribune.com, and they can buy an individual subscription. We circulate close to 55,000 people a week, mailed into their homes. We have about 2,000 or 3,000 companies that buy our papers simply because they want to keep track of what's going on. And we have a lot of individuals that buy the paper as well because they want to keep track of what's going on in the labor movement. We not only cover the St. Louis and Southern Illinois area, we also cover the national labor scene. Not as good as we would like, simply because all politics is local. The local news is what we focus on, but we also cover a lot of national and international labor news as well.
Well, Ed, I would love to talk to you in the future. As labor stories pop up, it's always great to meet other people with the same passion that I have. I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure. I wish you good luck.
Thanks so much, Ed Finkelstein, publisher of the St. Louis Southern Illinois Labor Tribune. And again, labortribune.com, the website. You can get to his site from ours. I'll just click on his name, take you right to the... Right there. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
So Rick's off to Florida with his family. We'll be playing encore performances of the People's Tour right through the new year.
No, wait, I'm still here.
Rick, what are you doing here?
Well, Pat, I wanted to make sure that we were playing the People's Tour while I'm gone.
Rick, you and everyone else can rest assured that each night from 9 until midnight, we'll hear some of the very best interviews from our trip across the country, exploring labor history.
Right here, 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Last year, 120,000 people over the age of 60 in the United States of America had their Social Security payments garnished because of student loan debt. It is a multi-generational crisis. And anybody who has, you know, sweated over their sons and daughters' student loan payments knows that it's not just about students. It's about all of us.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. We're here in Detroit, the People's Tour for America, another stop along the Grand Path. We are in the building that housed local Teamsters Local 299, the historic local of James R. Hoffa. I actually got to sit at the desk, and you know, the thing that amazes me, still a working desk. The guy who's the president there now still sits behind that desk. I just think is remarkable. I'm sitting here with Greg Nowak. He's the president of the Michigan Teamsters, the guy who's in charge of the whole state here. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, you're welcome, Rick.
You know, I got to be honest, as somebody who was a Teamster for 20 years, you know, sitting at that desk, you know, thinking about all of the history, all of the, I was under the National Master Freight Agreement for years, which I think was, one of those major monumental contracts that made so many people's lives better.
Yeah. There is not only a piece of history, Rick. If you look at it, there were an awful lot of decisions made behind that desk that influenced everybody in this state, in this country. And James R. Hoffa, along with James P. Hoffa, his son, following in his legacy, was an awful lot of decisions made on behalf of an awful lot of people that affected directly, the middle class, when there was a true middle class, the way we understood it back then, for those of us that are old enough.
Yeah, I go back to my grandparents' generation. My grandfather, he started after World War II working on the back of a coal truck. He was shoveling coal for 17 cents an hour. Right. Living in poverty, they were homeless at that point.
Yes.
And over the years, because of the decisions made at that desk, as a truck driver, he made it into a solidly middle class lifestyle and retired with dignity. And, that's something I fear not going to be possible for my kids.
And the one thing, and there's a lot of slogans, cliches, dignity, respect. People nowadays don't understand what respect actually is for the working class people. The Koch brothers, we were having a conversation off air, and you have people such as the Koch brothers that have absolutely no concern about the working class, men or women, and it's so many double income families. Back when James R. Hoffa was here, it was almost a pride and proud to be a single income family, so the wife could be home to mother the kids. And the thing is, when Dad got home after a tough, he could go to a middle income house or a nice little house with a white picket fence. That's what we stood for. That's what he stood for. And I think we're going to get back there. It's going to be a long, drawn out fight, but by God, not only Michigan, if you look at it, I think that there's an awful lot of things that the state right to work. A bump in the road, I think it is, but a huge one, no. Can we rebound? Will we rebound? Yes. You see what's going on around the country, and it is a little bit, it's disheartening, but the thing is, and go back to sitting behind that desk, men that have in the past, not only James R., since then, we all fight for a common goal, and it is that, to get back to there's nothing wrong with working awful hard for your wage, but by God, when somebody tries to take your right away, to bargain for that, it is disappointing. And we will get back there. This state, along with an awful lot of other people that helped me throughout this state, a lot of other good unions, we will get back there. We will definitely. Detroit is resilient, Michigan is resilient, and we'll get back to where we've got to be.
Yeah, and I think it has to happen, and I think things are ripe right now for organizing, because we have seen since 2008, since what I think was a depression, had it not been for Social Security and unemployment and food stamps, I think we would have been full-blown into a depression. I think, since then, what we've seen is we've seen all of the profits go to these huge corporations, CEO pay never higher, profits as a percentage of GDP never higher, wages never lower. And I think there's a point where people go, I've had my fill of you-know-what. And there's only so much of that I'm willing to eat, and now we're going to come back together.
I think that you're not only right. I believe that the mistake, whether it be Snyder or the right wing, has made is it you want to say woke up a sleeping giant? I think what it did is make people cognizant of the fact that my wages have not grown the way that in all of the rhetoric that we went through when we went to right to work. With the stats show, right to work is not good for a state. It's good for employers. It's good for those profits that you're talking about, those margins that are far too big. Equalize them, bring them, let them filter down to the grassroots people, the boots on the ground, the people that make this world turn around. This nation is as strong as they can be. It can be, but at the end of the day, just give me a fair day's wage for a fair day's work. I can go home and enjoy my family. My kids can be brought up
in a good environment, and I can afford to send them to school. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Not an Ivy League school. If we're just an honest day's pay, that's all we're looking for, not to have people trample all over us, give us our rights and give us our wages. That's it. And the ability to negotiate. And when we're done negotiating, just pay us what you said you would. Treat us like human beings with that respect, regardless of race, regardless of gender. Just pay us the way we are. We respect you. You respect us.
And that's a huge part of it. You know, we've been on this tour. We've gone to a number of the states that are right to work. And I hate to use that frame because, you know, originally, and I've said this a number of times, right to work was a labor statement. We want to have the right to a job. We want to be able to support our families, reasonable wages. And the right wing in this country has co-opted that. And so, well, you have the right to work. And what it turns out, their vision of right to work is, well, basically for free or in prison labor conditions. Right. So I hate to use that frame, but we've been to a number of states where that's the law. And you talk to the people there who say, you know, we were in Memphis, the sanitation workers who Martin Luther King was in Memphis when he was assassinated to support the sanitation workers. Today, they still don't have a pension. Because they're a right-to-work state.
Right. It's deplorable when you get, like I'm saying, and I believe that they have, when you hear right-to-work, people, and we had Prop 2, as you know, here in Michigan, and we, unfortunately, our efforts didn't pay off. But when people hear right to work, they think that, wow, that should be. You should have the right to work. And, again, it's a misnomer. We tried to educate people, but a lot of times I believe that we don't. We don't think past our front door, which is, it's understandable. You've got your family within those, but we have to, one, think outside of the house, the box. They woke us up. So now the American people in a state, the people in this state of Michigan can truly say, my God, you know what? You try to tell them what right to work really means, that us as labor leaders, we have to, as your business representative, we have to represent them that don't pay dues. That's what we call freeloaders. And they'll look you in the face, they'll look you in the eye and say, well, that's not true. That's not what that means. And you have to explain it. You have to educate it. And then after even going through part of that process, they understand. So, no, you're right. Why should you have to defend them? And why does that can't be the law? It is the law. And there is the ability for us to, I mean, it is their effort, meaning the corporations, to defeat us because they know we have to take resources paid by all to defend, or excuse me, resources paid by some to defend all. And it's not right. And the thing is, as their profits grow, ours will shrink, our power will shrink. But I'm still here to tell you that I believe that we can and we will. We will be resilient. We will be. 2014 is going to be a big year for this state. And the thing is, I think that they helped us make people aware and given us the tools. Dave Hecker just talked. He's from the educational field. The thing is, I think it's a big part of our program has got to be, and that's what I'm trying to do, is educate our members, educate the general public, and educate the voters, because it's not right.
I'm with you. You know, and I look at this, and we use a clip in one of our intros quite often. A congressman from Tennessee, Zach Womp, I'm sure you've probably heard of him, he said about the Volkswagen plant, and when the UAW workers were saying, hey, you know, we'd like to protect our pensions, don't let Chrysler and GM go under, he said, you know, they should be allowed to fail because Volkswagen invested in Tennessee, a right-to-work state, and this is the key, with less wages and less health care. I mean, the thing that it's gotten to me at this point is they're very honest about it. We want to steal wages. We want to steal benefits. We want to make sure that we go back 100 years. And I don't think that the vast majority of the American public hear that yet.
Yeah. But isn't that, Rick, don't you think? And here's my problem is a lot of times if it doesn't involve you or I, unfortunately, we don't care. If we care, we don't care as much because, you know, I don't work at that plant. I don't, unfortunately, with my own local, we deliver, you know, beer, liquor. We've got an awful lot of people that work extremely hard. But if I don't work at one of those places, it's kind of difficult for us to focus on, well, the UAW, they hang bumpers on cars. Well, you know what? They work hard. They work hard every day like we do out in the elements. And darn it, if I don't care what they're doing, they're not going to care what I'm doing. We've got to change that. We've got to bring the focus back to where we were years ago when James R. Hoffa was here, because he was not afraid to jump up on a running board of a truck and explain his wishes and his beliefs of to what, you know, you're driving that truck, you're away from your family, you deserve. You're taking an awful lot. You know, there's responsibility on you, but you should be paid, and there's nothing wrong with a good wage.
Absolutely not. But, and we need to go back to the idea of an injury to one as an injury at all.
Exactly.
And that runs, you know, counter to what we've been told for at least all of my life, that we're an individual, and basically the hooray for me and the hell with everybody else mentality.
Yeah. Well, and again, here in Detroit, we've had an awful lot of struggles, the newspaper struggle, we've had the... You know, there's so many times that you look and you have people, what do we do as leaders? We have to get people to rally around us, rally around a cause. Well, you know what? We have a cause right here, right now. Right to work is by far a huge, huge cause to everybody. In a union or not in a union, it is, and again, those stats are proven to be true. A right-to-work state, your wages are lower. So if we, again, get that explanation out to people that they truly understand and believe that right-to-work is not good, it's not good for the state, and it's not good for the middle class or the working class. It's to the opposite. It's to, one, not only deteriorate them, it's to eliminate them.
Well, I mean, it's not just wages, too. I mean, you look at the health care, you look at pensions, you look at safety on the job. I mean, all of the numbers, the facts are there. It's just that, you know, the right uses such flowery rhetoric.
Sure. And the thing is here, our illustrious, you know, governor, I mean, he started out by eliminating, you know, MyOSHA, which our safety. I mean, it's just you could see their game plan. We followed. We didn't have to follow. That's, I think, the difference between the Republican Party and us. It's just a matter of when we have the opportunity, we want to treat people fair. We want to treat people with respect and fair, and they're absolutely not. They showed us. They showed us what we should have been like over history shows. And the thing is, this is decimating. Supposedly, you know, their plan was not that. It looked everybody in the eye. We weren't going to have right to work. It was a total flat-out-and-out lie. He's a politician. It was. But then you eliminate the safety of workers in a state, and that's his, it should be, one of his most important jobs is to most certainly take care of the people that are in your state.
You would think. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're Greg Nowak. He's the president of Michigan Teamsters. You know, and we appreciate you bringing us into your hall here, this historic area, and something I enjoyed my time looking around the James R. Hoffa office, which is still a working office to me. Just I'm still getting my head around that. You know, as we've been doing this tour, we've been talking about labor history. We've been talking about people's personal history. And I'm curious, you know, my grandfather was a Teamster. It came, you know, came in the household. You understood that, you know, that union, that job, that was the key to the middle class. I think a generation has lost that. And I'm curious, you know, how did you get to where you are? How did you get involved?
Well, I mean, fortunately for myself, I come from a family. My father was a UAW skilled tradesman. UAW person, and I started out at Stroh Brewery Company back in 1973. Shortly thereafter, found that we needed I ran for steward. We needed somebody that just could represent people. I think, kind of an uncanny knack of just not being a smart aleck, but saying, hey, this is only what's fair. I'm only asking what's fair. Why would you do this? Why would you do that? Since 1981, I ran for two offices. I was fortunate enough to win both and then progressed up through the ranks here. I've been on the Joint Council for quite a few years, but I think it's all, it is what you believe. It's not that you close the office door at 5 o'clock. It's not that you don't. I meet a tremendous, like you said, I mean, a tremendous amount of good people. I think trying to be a good labor leader, and I mean trying, it encompasses trying to surround yourself and be in the company of quality people that are true people. Not tell you one thing and do another. And the thing is, that's how I've always carried that belief. I've got an awful lot of people that over the years from the management side of the table, shaking hands with, done deals, and I respect them because they followed everything they said they're going to do. There are good employers out there, and I think any employer that can live in the confines of a labor agreement, they're a good employer.
That's
exactly right. And then you have the other side that'll shake your hand, look at you in the eye, and they'll turn right around. And that's what made me drive, because I had a good history at Stroh's, but then since then I've had an awful lot of people in an awful lot of spots that don't do that. And they hire, you know, attorneys and hired guns that just union busters. And see, that's the bad thing. You get union busters that actually make a heck of a living off of the backs of working people. no dignity, no respect. They make the money, and what they, these employers in some instances pay them more than they would have had to be fair and reasonable with their employees.
Yeah, it's all
that's
about,
what drives me.
It's all about the power. And I go back to Diane Hendricks, who, you know, there's a famous clip of her talking with Scott Walker. She's a billionaire. If you don't know who she is, she's this big multi-billionaire. There's nothing on this planet she can't afford, except she wants right to work. And she, a famous, famous clip of her, you know, talking to Scott Walker, all tingly in the panties. Oh, when can we have right to work? And, you know, you think about it, you know, what would make a billionaire who can afford anything on this planet want that one thing? And, you know, I come back to it, it's absolute and total complete power.
Yeah.
Their power over everyone and in imposing their will on people.
Yeah.
Which is why I tell folks, I tell our listeners, look, this is one of the main reasons you want to fight back against this, because they want it so bad. Because my old man always said, you know, if a rich guy's going to spend a buck to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get.
Yep. And it's true. I mean, the thing is, once you have greed, I think, drives people to money. But the truth is, after greed, I think a step above greed is that power you're talking about, because they can buy anything they want. They can buy anything except for that power. And the thing is, to have them to change something that takes an awful lot of work, that's what bothers me. They're not into hard work. They're into paying somebody that does not have to work that awful hard to get it. But again, it's always off the backs of the working individual that's down there, whether they're stocking shelves at a store, whether they're shoveling snow for a city, a municipality, whether they're a fireman, a policeman, a beer driver, anything of that nature. They're always working hard, and they can't, unfortunately, they can't buy. They can't buy respect, but that's the thing. They've got that ultimate power, and that's what they chase, because they think that they've got that ultimate power, and that's up to us to try to take it away.
Yeah, last question I've got for you. In seeing the assaults here in Michigan, things that are going on in Pennsylvania, all the austerity that's going on, you know, what message do we tell working people? Because, you know, we've seen profits, like I said, never higher, wages never lower. You know, what's the message that you want to tell people? You know, how do we turn this thing around?
Well, I think that, one, they got to believe. And I think the most important thing is we've got an awful lot of good leadership here. They got to believe. They've got to listen. In social media now, and again, even that this is a step in a right direction. We have to have people listen to your show, to hear people say what they believe and honestly believe in what they say. That's the difficulty. And the thing is, it's up to us as leaders to educate our members, educate, again, the people in this state of Michigan, to get back where we won, where we should be. And we will. But that's the message, is you got to pay attention to. We all have newsletters. We do everything we possibly can. But you can mail it to the house. It's very difficult to get them to read it. Now, and we've got some social media ways that we're trying to communicate with our members, but we've got to get that message across, but we've got to get them to be agreeable to read it and have a cause. And by God, we've got a cause.
And if we wanted to check in on that stuff, Facebook page, Twitter, all that stuff?
Most certainly.
And how do we get
Circle is what we've got. We've got a website, and right now about 80% of the locals in the state of Michigan have a Union Circle website that you can jump on there. There's contests. And every day there's a different labor story on that website, which is good. And, again, our organizers are on it. You can keep in tune with what we have. And again, it's all part of, again, our plan to get this state, you know, in 2014 where we have to be. We have to be heard, and the thing is, we've got to build our army between now and November of 2014. Absolutely.
Not just here in Michigan, but Pennsylvania and Ohio.
Exactly.
and a lot of the states, Wisconsin, a lot of places across the country. Greg, it was great talking with you. We'll make sure we get links up for those sites and our site, thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Greg Nowak's name. It'll take you right there. Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Quick break from the road. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
What do you give a guy who has everything?
Labor history, of course.
And where can you get a great dose of labor history?
Right here, weeknights from 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show.
From New York City factories to West Virginia coal mines to Oregon loading docks to Toledo glass factories, you'll hear all the stories right here, right up until the new year.
And then we'll be back with all new shows here on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Corporate shareholders are revolting in the very best sense of that term. More and more investor groups today are rebelling against the top managers of some of the corporations they own. Why? because the executives had been gambling on political races, not with their own money, but with the money that shareholders have invested in the corporations. In other words, the execs are treating investor funds as their personal pile of political chips, not even bothering to tell the shareholders about it, much less asking permission or consulting them on who to support. While Washington fiddles with proposals to require that corporate executives at least inform investors about all political use of their money, shareholders themselves are taking action. Since 2010, there's been a doubling of shareholder resolutions at corporate board meetings to force executives to disclose such spending and reveal the process for deciding which candidates to back. A New York pension fund, for example, has compelled political disclosure by the managers of 20 corporations in which it has big investments, including Dr. Pepper, Harley-Davidson, and Southwest Airlines. Recently, this pension fund forced a vote on disclosure at the board meeting of CF Industries. CFI's board had earlier opposed the resolution unanimously, haughtily declaring that our corporate political contributions are always both in the business interests of the company and its shareholders. In other words, go away, little people. Stop bothering us. A pod of slugs wouldn't be as clueless as that. Sure enough, by a vote of 65.9%, shareholders emphatically supported the disclosure resolution. This is Jim Hightower saying, to keep up with this spreading shareholder revolt against secret corporate politicking, contact the Center for Political Accountability at www.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com, the People's Tour for America. If you've missed any part of the tour, where we've been, who we've talked to, you can go to the website, People'sTourForAmerica.com. We're here in Detroit. And, you know, the mainstream media keeps showing us images of neighborhoods falling down, of boarded-up buildings, neighborhoods being bulldozed. You know, I understand just recently the city set aside all of the contracts for its workers. This is a city in turmoil. But the question is, how did it get this way? And as I was driving in today, you know, you look at these big, beautiful homes. How did we get here? Which is why we've asked Scott Martell. He's the author of Detroit, A Biography, to come talk to us. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome. Thanks for the interest.
You know, so I look at this, and I look at this city of big, beautiful buildings crumbling. And I go, how did we get here?
Well, it's a long story.
Which is why you've written the book on it.
Four reasons for it. Exactly. It takes a whole book to explain it. The key thing is Detroit had a very diversified economy through the late 1800s into the early 1900s. And then along came the auto industry, and that just sort of trumped everything in Detroit. And Detroit's, you know, sort of power brokers and economic brokers, put all their money into the auto industry, essentially. So Detroit grew as a one-industry town. And whenever there's a recession, you know, the things that people stop buying are the big-ticket items like cars. So Detroit has always been susceptible to these economic swings. And then the auto industry, you know, went through its problems, decentralization in the 50s, foreign competition beginning in the early 70s. And that all fell, you know, particularly heavy on Detroit as a city and as a community.
You know, and looking at that and going back, you know, this whole all your eggs in one basket mentality, you know, the thing that I had always heard is when times were good, they were really good. When times were bad, they were bad, but you knew at some point it would swing back around and the jobs would come back. But through globalization and through decentralization and all the things you've talked about, those jobs have gone to cheaper areas and gone to areas with less regulation and all of that. Or where did they go? I guess I should ask you. You wrote the book.
Well, first they scattered around the country. After World War II, as the auto industry was getting back into automaking mode, they began realizing that it made sense for them for a couple of reasons. When they were expanding and needed to build new factories, to build those factories in different parts of the country. The reason for that, there are multiple reasons. Some of them are solid business reasons and some of them not. The solid business reason is that they wanted to get the manufacturing centers closer to the markets for the cars. So they built some factories in California, which, you know, makes sense from a business standpoint. But at the same time, they're also trying to get into locations, particularly in the South, where they thought they would have a better chance fighting off the UAW. You know, one of their big concerns about car production in the Detroit area was how strong the UAW was. So they had a lot of desire to get away from the union force. It didn't work ultimately, but that was one of the things that was propelling their decisions.
Yeah, you look at this, and you know, you said a moment ago getting back into the auto business because they had built bombers and they had built tanks and they had built all the other things during World War II with their factories. And the thing that worries me and one of those things that makes me think today is we've given away that manufacturing capacity, and we drove past a number of the factories that were used for building bombers and for building tanks, and they're crumbling to the ground.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, it's fairly popular to blame the auto executives for making those decisions. And in a way, they do bear a lot of responsibility for it. You know, they were abandoning the communities that first made those corporations so great. But our whole political structure and legal structure sort of forces them into those decisions. As I mentioned near the end of my book, you know, expecting corporations to behave differently is like expecting a dog not to be a dog.
Right.
You know, when you're a member of a board of directors of a corporation, and it's your fiduciary responsibility to look out for the interest of the shareholders, the interest of the community, you know, falls far behind that. And that's the whole, you know, the national structure, national policy structure, that made it easier, made it, you know, palatable and actually necessary in some cases for the big corporations to make the decisions they made. So you can blame them for abandoning, you know, cities, but also, you know, the way our government is set up and our policies are set up, it sort of set them in that position.
Well, no, I absolutely blame the policies. This nonsensical free trade mantra we've been fed for this neoliberal free trade that we've been fed for 30 years.
It's like a national religion, and it's just that's the core of all of our problems, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and you look at, and we've gone across the country. We've gone to Kansas City and St. Louis and Chicago, here in Detroit, and a lot of these cities that had mighty industrial bases that produced the products that we as consumers purchased, and we basically gave those jobs away through insane trade agreements. I mean, I look at, you know, I think it was last year, for the first time in 100 years, the U.S. was not the largest producer of goods in the world. We didn't lose that. We gave it away.
Right. And the reason for that is this mindset that what's good for corporations is good for America. And that hasn't been the case for 60 years.
No, I mean,
that's what fueled the rise of the multinational corporations.
Yeah, I mean, I remember back in the 60s, you know, the what's good for GM is good for America.
Right.
Not so much now. I mean, what's good for Walmart, not good for the U.S.
Exactly. But even if going back to the production and the manufacturing core, you know, what is good for GM now is good for GM. It's not good for Detroit. It's not necessarily good for America. It's good for GM and good for GM shareholders. So when you have national policies outside the auto industry, you have national policies that allow corporations to profit by building things overseas and then selling them to American consumers. Yeah, that's a cycle that's bound to break at some point. You know, the consumers, the more, ultimately, the fewer consumers you develop, and you just erode, you know, the entire economy of your own country. But it's good for corporations, because individual corporations are making profits.
So when did all of this start? I mean, when did all of this policy, this push towards globalization, when did all of this bad policy, in your opinion, when did this start?
Well, I'm going to have to punt on that, because that's not my area of expertise. All I could do is give you a guess, and I believe it dates back to the 70s. But, you know, America from the get-go has been all about, not from the get-go, since probably the early 1900s, America has been all about free trade. It's kind of ironic that back in 1896, McKinley ran for president successfully as a Republican, and one of the things he was pushing for was tariffs that would protect labor. Yeah, so the Republican Party has gone the complete reverse on that, and you know, the mainstream of the Democratic Party has joined them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Republicans love to throw Lincoln out there, but Lincoln would not be recognizable in today's Republican Party, nor, I believe, would Ronald Reagan be recognizable.
No, I agree. I mean, it's gone from a party of economic conservatism, which is a defensible political position, I believe. I don't hold it, but it's a defensible position. But it's gone from that, you know, to this sort of ludicrous extreme of, you know, social conservatives and, you know, these weird, you know, anti-abortion laws they're trying to push through in Texas and places like that. So it's no longer, you know, I think Goldwater warned Republicans about this back in the 60s, saying if the preachers ever take charge of the Republican Party, you know, the party's going to be in trouble. And I'm afraid that's what's happened. So, you know, when you can pick Goldwater as sort of your lodestar for the things that have happened to the country, you know the world has gone kind of crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one of the frames the mainstream media uses, and I hear this often about Detroit and about other cities that had strong manufacturing bases that were heavily unionized, and it was the union's fault. They just got greedy. Those workers, they just wanted too much, and that forced all of this. All these jobs to flee. How much truth is in that, in your opinion?
I think there's some of it. I don't blame the unions for wanting too much. I mean, the whole point of unions is to look out for the interests of the workers. And you know, it's like, you know, blaming a lawyer for trying too hard to defend a client. And that is the role of unions. But in some cases, the unions did wind up achieving a lot that no longer became supportable as the economy more broadly eroded. And that's sort of, you know, the unions get blamed for that, and I think that's an unfair amount of blame to put on them. If, you know, the policies allow manufacturers to move jobs overseas, and you are the old family-held company of Company X making widgets, and all of your competitors are building their widgets overseas for a fraction of your cost, you know, what do? I mean, do you stay and do the right thing with your union people, or do you get rid of the union jobs and move your jobs overseas? You know, it's kind of a rock and a hard place for people in that position. But I don't think there's a whole lot of weight to the argument that unions caused this. I think that's just a convenient, you know, argument by the anti-union movement.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Scott Martell. He is the author of Detroit, A Biography. How do we get the book Detroit, A Biography?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
How do we get it? How do we buy your book?
Oh, how do we get? Okay, I think about how did I get to it?
Yeah, how do we get?
I sat down on my computer and I read it. It's available through the usual online places, which is kind of ironic. You can get it at Amazon, which is one of those businesses that's putting, you know, mom and pop neighborhood stores out of business. You can get it through Barnes and Noble. You can order it. You know, it's through a regular distributor, so you can order it from your local bookstore.
I like to use Powell's myself, so we'll make sure we'll get a link
fine,
to it. We'll make sure
we get
a link to it on the RickSmithShow.com's website. Let me ask you now, you know, we've been through Detroit and we're seeing the blight, we're seeing the result of deindustrialization and you know, which is crumbling homes and abandoned buildings and all the poverty and the crime and all that. What's the future for Detroit? Is there a rebirth possible? Is there a rebirth going on?
Yes to both, but the rebirth that's going on isn't really the kind of rebirth that's going to bring the city back. Detroit peaked with a population of just over 1.8 million people in 1950, and now it's below 700,000. And the vast majority of those 700,000 are part of the old Michael Harrington cycle of poverty that he defined in his The Other America book in the early 60s. You know, these are you know, single mothers, high school dropouts, raising kids, in places where there is no real functional institutions, you know, the schools don't work, local government doesn't work, as we've seen. You know, it's just sort of, you know, all the things you expect in a social order to exist have kind of collapsed. And when you go to downtown Detroit now, which is, you know, coming back, it's lively, there's some investment in buildings. You go to the Wayne State corridor area, you know, there's a lot of buzz going on there. And that's great, and it should be applauded. But if you go a half mile in any direction from that, you're back into, you know, what Detroit is writ large. And until we can find some way to link what's happening in these sort of seed growth areas to the neighborhoods, you're not going to get Detroit to bounce back in any sort of way. What you're going to get is two Detroits. You're going to get, you know, sort of a yuppie Detroit, hipster Detroit, and then you're going to get everything else, your neighborhood Detroit.
And, you know, you look at this, and exactly everything that the Walter Ruthers of the world and the labor movement fought against.
Yeah, exactly. And the only way Detroit, I think, is going to have any sort of real chance of coming back is if they find a way to bridge this black-white divide and the urban-suburban divide. And that, you know, that courses every decision made in Detroit. And you know, you can see it in Facebook comments and comments on news articles. Whenever something bad happens in Detroit, you get, you know, the white suburbanites saying, you know, they, meaning the blacks, wanted their city, now they got it, they can have it. You know, it's that kind of of, you know, just aggressive racism. And so they can get beyond that. They're going to have a lot of trouble, you know, having the city of Detroit come back itself. But some of the heartening news is there was a three-county bond initiative, I think in the last election cycle, to tax people in Wayne, Macomb, and Oakland counties to support the Detroit Institute of Arts, which is a city gem. And that passed. And I took that as a heartening sign. I mean, the people in that metro area were finally realizing that they are inextricably linked, and it's in their mutual best interest to do positive things to try to shore up some of these institutions in Detroit. So I take that as a positive sign and hope they can build on that.
Yeah, I hope so, too, because, you know, to see a city like Detroit of once, you know, just enormous prominence and wealth in the state that it's in, I wonder what the future holds for us as a nation.
And that's sort of what I read about in my book, is are we looking at Detroit's industrial, I'm sorry, when you look at Detroit, are you looking at the nation's industrial past, or are you looking at the nation's urban future? And that's kind of the policy decision we have to make as a country.
It all comes back to the decisions we make at the ballot box. Scott, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time. The book, Detroit, A Biography, written by Scott Martell, you can get it. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com so you can pick it up. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, and I appreciate the interest.
Thanks. Anytime. Quick break, right back from the People's Tour for America here in Detroit, Michigan. Stick around.
And they're talking in the town square. They're talking in the town square. They're talking everywhere. They're talking everywhere.
Your proud defender of the working class.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history. Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
We need to stand united, for undivided we shall never fall. Remember all, we need to trust in and then forever call. Our brothers and our sisters, and are you and I aware? You and I both know that we can't rely on it. The time is prime, fast aligned, ain't no mistaking. For union resurrection, the anger has awakened. Has awakened. The sleeping giant, come on, yeah, we can do it. We need to revive, re-amp, and re-up the labor movement.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. The People's Tour for America has rolled into Detroit, Michigan, and what an amazing trip this has been. But I got to tell you, as we moved in, as we came into the city, you see the houses that are abandoned and boarded up, and there's so much opportunity here. And for me, it's all this austerity that we keep hearing about in our budgets. I know our governor just passed the budget there, I guess they've got a talking point. 3 years in a row, they've passed a really bad budget that doesn't invest in much in education or in infrastructure. Still no transportation bill. Hey, where's the transportation bill? Nowhere. But I look at all the opportunity lost, and it's frustrating on so many levels. Our governor loves to say, hey, we're centrally located. We can bring business here. Well, you know why people come to a state? Education, infrastructure, and location. Kind of an idea. I'm sitting here with David Hecker. He's the president of AFT Michigan, the American Federation of Teachers here in the area. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
I look at in our state, our governor for two of the past 3 years has taken $1 billion each of those 2 years out of education. I guess they put a couple of pennies back in this last budget. And it's this disinvestment in the future that has me beyond angry, and this disinvestment in my kids' future. And I understand Michigan's kind of the same playbook.
Unfortunately, same playbook. 2 years ago, the legislature and Governor Snyder took $1 billion out of K-12 education, slashed higher education by 15%, did all that in addition to cutting the earned income tax credit, so less assistance for the low income, increased taxes on seniors. All those things in the name of giving corporations a $1.8 billion tax break.
The welfare.
Corporate welfare. And the pennies he's put back in education haven't come close to negating, let alone increasing, the tremendous cuts of 2 years ago. And so now we have I guess, self-fulfilling prophecies. We have a district, Buena Vista, in the middle part of the state that closed down in the beginning of May because they ran out of money, and the state did come in and bail them out. We have the Inkster School District with a terrible, terrible deficit, a major, major deficit. We have the Albion School District, which said it's no longer going to operate a high school because they're too expensive to run. So the kids will go to a high school in another district next door, and Albion will operate as K-8. And it's no great surprise that these things are happening when you slash education funding.
Well, it's disaster capitalism at its finest. Mm-hmm. You create a disaster, and then you benefit from it. You know, where we're at, you know, I keep telling people, look at the Philadelphia School District, mm-hmm. how they've defunded that. And
right.
and it's then this push to close down the public schools and
right.
move them into charter schools or
right.
to, you know, and you could say that, well, they're not for profit. But, you know, you look at the underpinnings of all of the money that's being sucked out of education. And, mm-hmm. you know, you mentioned the Buena Vista School District. The teachers there offered to work for free.
That's right.
And they said, no, we're not
right.
going to let them even work for
that's
free.
Right. The teachers who...
The
greedy teachers who the governor and the Republican-controlled legislature attack on an almost daily basis. It is all part of a grand plan, and it's all part of a grand plan to severely undercut public education. You mentioned charters. In Michigan, 85% of charters are run by for-profit companies.
Really?
85% are run by for-profit companies.
Because the talking point in Pennsylvania, anyway, is that, well, they're just like public schools, mm-hmm. and they're not for profit. I'm going, but wait a minute. You know, the guy in Philadelphia who took $16 million from the Chester Upland School District for himself before anyone in the public school got paid, and those teachers went without pay for months, where'd that money go?
Well, and there's also been a ruling by the National Labor Relations Board, because the AFT, we've been active in organizing charters here, had a big win in January, organized, you ready for this? The Cesar Chavez Charter School. Many Cesar Chavez Charter Schools around the country, which are unorganized, a little ironic.
Yeah, kind of.
Horrible. Teachers were great. We organized 240 teachers, the largest charter school in the city of Detroit, the second largest in the state. Now we're talking with the support staff, but in Chicago, AFT's also been extremely active and successful in organizing charter schools. And you know, there's always been a question: does it go to the public employee relations board, called different things in different states, or does it go to the National Labor Relations Board? And the ruling was that since the school boards for charters are not elected. They're appointed boards, and because of other factors about charter schools, is they really the jurisdiction is the National Labor Relations Board, unless
that's why we've got to destroy the NLRB.
Unless they're structured so differently in other states, right? And for the National Labor Relations Board, for those people who don't like unions, is we don't have a National Labor Relations Board.
Yeah, I mean, that's
right.
And again, once you say, you know, workers have a right, and look,
right.
at the end of this, teachers are workers too. And, you know, I have a friend who's a retired PSEA member, Pennsylvania State mm-hmm. Education Association mm-hmm. member, and she said, you know, before we had the right to organize and get a decent wage, we had to have little Johnny and Susie brought us apples for lunch.
Right.
We needed that.
Right. And, you know, that is not as far as apples for the teacher's lunch, but what is needed in many districts, including right here where we're sitting, the city of Detroit, and other districts that are suffering so much, is that, you know, teachers bring in the supplies. Teachers bring in the toilet paper for the bathrooms. These basic supplies that schools are not able to provide. Teachers, there was a study done in Detroit, and I'm sure this would apply to just about every school district around. A study done in Detroit more than a couple of years ago, probably 6, 7, 8 years ago, in which on average, a teacher took $2,000 a year out of their pocket to help fund what was needed in the classroom that the school district did not fund.
Yeah, I saw one in Pennsylvania. It was like $2,200.
Yeah, same thing.
It's in,
right.
in the same range.
Right.
And we're not talking people who, you know, I know the mainstream corporate-controlled media loves to say that, you know, teachers are highly paid. They get these gilded pensions.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the teachers I know make $25,000-$30,000 a year to start, and then maybe upwards of $45,000-$50,000. So $2,200 out of their paycheck
is a lot of money.
Is a whole lot of money.
Is a lot of money. Right. Yeah, no, the... The attacks on teachers, Pennsylvania, Michigan, every place else, it's just amazing. You know, these are people who we entrust our children to, and then some people feel like, well, we'll just go after them and attack them. We'll take away their voice. We'll take away their rights, as if limiting the voice and rights of our education leaders, our teachers, actually helps education. Someone has to explain to me how limiting the voice of people schooled in, knowledgeable about education, who teach our children, limiting their voice, how that helps the education of a child.
Do you think it has to do with this corporate mentality that everything can be like an assembly line? Since we're here in Detroit, you know, you think about the Ford, the UAW and the Ford workers, everything's an assembly line, and those kids that come before us are little, you know, just little pieces of metal to be stamped out and little vessels to have information poured into each other, and really the brain drain of education where it's factory work.
It's factory work in the sense that they do not respect the skill of teaching at all. You know, we stole
this. Because we just teach the test.
That's right. We stole this. So I'm not saying this is original with us. I don't know who originally came up with it. But those who can teach, those who can teach, pass laws about teaching. And, there is no respect on the part of some people, in the political world who perhaps more likely belong to a certain party. For the skill of teaching. They think that if you know math, you could walk in and teach math. If you know chemistry, you could walk in and teach chemistry. They, you know, the total refusal to acknowledge the impact poverty has on a family,
on anything,
on a child, on everything, on all of society, You know, the fact that there are far, 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 far too many places in Detroit where poverty is just block to block to block, that impacts the Birmingham, which for your listeners is a well-off suburb of Detroit. That impacts the Birminghams. It impacts everything, but most importantly, it impacts the family in poverty, it impacts their neighborhood, and it impacts the child. And, you know, I oftentimes, when I have the opportunity to do an interview, I just, you know, and the person interviewing me perhaps is not you, and perhaps doesn't think poverty has an impact, I just go right to my family, and I say, listen, you know, you're going to tell me that my kids, okay, who thanks to the labor movement, because my wife worked over 20 years for the UAW, thanks to the labor movement, my three kids, we are able to provide them with whatever is needed to supplement their education, whatever else is needed. My kids, thanks to the labor movement, have traveled the country, have traveled in other places in the world, thanks to the labor movement. They've had experiences that a child in poverty cannot possibly have. You know, my kids come home to, you know, two laptops and a desktop. That is not an advantage for a kid. How can anybody tell me that is not an advantage for a child?
Yeah, and to highlight that, you know, my kids were doing this cross-country labor history tour because I want them to have that experiential learning, which I think is so important. And I go back to my own personal story. I grew up in a housing project on the west side mm-hmm. of Cleveland. We didn't have those things.
Mm-hmm.
So I see both sides of this, and I mm-hmm. understand where the poverty comes from. I understand where the poverty can really hold people back,
mm-hmm.
and which is why I think it's interesting, and I don't know how Michigan funds their education, but in Pennsylvania, they do it by school districts, and they're all nicely divided
mm-hmm.
up,
right.
Where I've always said, why isn't there one pot of money and every kid in the state get the exact same amount put into their education all across the board? And I'll bet you if we had that, I'll bet you, you know, the districts in Philadelphia that were the very well-to-do spend $20,000
right.
per child, and you know, six or seven in the poor areas. I'll bet you that would help the poorer areas, and I'll bet you'd see a lot more money going to education if that were the case.
That's right, and I would even argue that some districts, usually the districts in lower-income communities, because of what poverty brings to the table, should get more money because they have additional things that need to deal with that, for example, I'm able to provide my children, my wife and I, thanks to the labor movement, parents in poverty want to provide for their kids but just don't have the resources to do. I have said many, many, many times that Michigan, and I'm sure this applies to other states as well, but Michigan funds their schools like a rich child is more important and worth more than a poor child.
Yeah, it's the same, just the same in Pennsylvania. Let me ask you this, David. You know, as in having numerous conversations, both on large scales and individually with folks over the years about teachers and education, I've yet to find someone who will look me in the eye and say, well, that teacher's a bad teacher. Then when you get them to talk in general terms, well, there are bad teachers out there. We don't know where they are. It's like the welfare queen driving around in the Cadillac eating somewhere. Because we've been told they're out there.
Right.
How much of it is, do you think, of the media hysteria of that there are bad teachers and we got to get them out? Because everyone agrees if there's a bad teacher, they should probably do something
else.
Right. But how much of you think it is the mainstream media saying, you know, they're out there and being us being force-fed that? Because, you know, most of the time I talk to people, it's kind of like Congress. Congress sucks. Right. But my guy's good.
That's right. Every poll on education is statistically impossible. You know, the my kid's teacher is great. My school district is an A. The school districts around me are a B+. Public education in America is a C-. You know, it's statistically impossible. But the reason it comes out that way, we know, is because you know about your child's teacher. You know about your child's school district. You perhaps know a little bit more about a neighboring school district. All you know about public education in general is what you read in the media, as you said. So while it's statistically impossible, it's understandable why it comes out that way. The broad brush of, you know, we have all these bad teachers. Is one, it's done to undermine public education, because why would I support public education if all these teachers are bad? But I'll also suggest it's done to undermine the Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers, because of the attacks on our members and the portrayal to the public that, you know, the example you gave, that if someone is a bad teacher, a fair evaluation shows that, and if the district helps the teacher get better and the teacher does not, the teacher should move on and no longer be teaching. You know, the stereotype is the teacher unions protect that bad teacher when it's the exact opposite. But by saying that, you're undercutting the Education Association, you're undercutting the American Federation of Teachers.
Yeah, what I love is we love teachers. It's those teachers' unions we don't like.
That's teachers'
unions,
right.
I love that frame because they use the same thing about government. They use the thing about unions as a whole. It's divorcing all of the people that are members of that organization from the organization. It's, well, we don't like them, right. But we like you.
Well, it's a standard what goes on in an organizing guide, right? It's third-partying the union. Like, the union is anything but the members.
Yep.
Like, AFT Michigan is David Hecker rather than our 30,000 members. And again, you know, they don't want to admit that the union are the teachers, are the truck drivers, are their paraprofessionals, are the auto workers, because then they're attacking the citizens who they want to have vote for them, right? So they want to just try to third party. We don't need this third party in our great family. Oh yeah, the family that's screwing you, but we don't need this third party.
So let me ask you, David Hecker, you know, as we go forward, and there are a lot of areas, especially in the high poverty areas, that have problems. How do we solve those? I mean, you know, in Pennsylvania, they keep talking about failing schools. And when you get down to the numbers, there's something like 3,500 school buildings in the state of Pennsylvania. They claim about 142 of them are, quote unquote, failing, however you want to make that assessment or that judgment. To me, that's a very small number, mm-hmm. something that we could fix without destroying the whole system. Mm-hmm. What should we be doing instead of this finger pointing, which I think goes at all the schools?
Well, there's a couple of we have to do things at a couple of different levels. For one, at the school level, we have to identify why that school is not doing as well as that school should do. That we want all our, you know, the criteria is where I send my kids to that school. If the answer is no, then no child should have to go to that school. But we need to identify why that school isn't getting the job done. Then we have to use not the gimmicks they always try to use, but research-based programs that have been proven to work and implement those at those schools. Now, that's on the school level. On the broader level, you know, it's a matter of public policy. First of all, we need an anti-poverty program.
Absolutely.
To bring people out of poverty. People don't speak about poverty.
And you had said at the beginning that they cut the EITC program,
sir. That's right here.
And what most people may not realize is EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, was something that the sainted Ronald Reagan brought in.
That's
because,
right.
Because Milton Friedman came up with the idea as part of his negative tax.
Right, that's right. So we need an anti-poverty program. We need to properly fund our schools. We need to get away from standardized tests, which has a place in education, but we have to get away from the standardized test is the be-all and end-all of everything. And we have to talk about students, what counts as students learning, not if they filled in the right box on a standardized test.
Well, I want critical thinking. I want my kids to be critical thinkers. I don't want them to be regurgitators,
right.
Which is why we did away with the standardized tests in our house. We opted our daughter out.
Okay.
Because, you know, they say next year 100% of the kids are going to have to pass the test or they're taking money away. It's never going to happen.
It is like Wobegon. You know, everybody's everyone's above average. On the No Child Left Behind, a number of states have gotten waivers on this since, but the original No Child Left Behind, 100% of the children need to be proficient. It's just statistical impossibility.
And, you know, to make this more personal, and I've said this before on the program, you know, the whole reason I made that choice, and that's an individual choice for parents to make. My daughter was teaching, my 11-year-old was play teaching in the living room, my 4-year-old, my 7-year-old. And she's telling them, you know, if you don't pass this test, they're going to take money away from us, they're going to close our schools. I don't think that's something an 11-year-old should be play teaching.
That's right. That's right. And it's such, you know, they talked about this in Michigan somewhat. This hasn't happened yet, but I'm not, you know, still fighting against it. If a school does real well, let's give it more money. And if a school isn't doing well, let's take away money. So explain to me how taking away resources from a school not doing well is going to help that school.
Oh, it's going to make them hungry.
It's going to make them hungry, right.
And of course, the American view is if you're hungry, you're going to have the fire in your belly, and you're going to fight, and you're going to pull yourself up by those things, the strap things.
Yes, bootstraps. Well, it's like merit pay, which they're trying to establish here across the board. You know, if at a local level that's negotiated, union and management, in a way that works for everyone, fine. But it shouldn't be mandated, and because the studies show that isn't what a teacher isn't going to come to school on Monday and say I'm going to teach better, because if that kid's points on the test go up 3 points, I'm going to get another $1,500. You know, that's every teacher goes to school every day, every support staff person goes to school every day wanting to do the absolute best job possible. They don't think about I'm not going to teach that well because I'm not getting merit pay if the test scores go up.
How
it works.
I can't tell you how many teachers I've talked to who said, you know, if I wanted to do something for money, this would be the last thing I would have done.
That's right.
And because it's the passion of teaching and the passion of seeing that look. And the one guy explained to me, you don't know maybe, but it's that look on their face when the kid goes, I got it.
That's right. I got it. And you help that kid get it. There isn't a check that could match that.
Or a standardized test that's going to bring that.
That's right. That's right.
David Hecker, we appreciate the time. Thanks so much. You know,
as
things go forward, we'd love to have you back on the program because, you know, what's going on in Michigan is going on in Pennsylvania.
That's right.
It's going on in Ohio.
That's right.
It's all part of this right wing. And I hate to use conspiracy because it's right out in the public. There's no conspiracy about it. It's what they're doing.
Hillary Clinton was right a number of years ago when she said that there it's a conspiracy. We all know that. Thank you, Rick.
David, appreciate the time. Quick break from Detroit, Michigan, the People's Tour for America. And, if you missed any portion of our program, thericksmithshow.com or peoplestourforamerica.com. Right back. Stick around.
To be wildcats striking. You know they're going to push us around. Mr. Pep and Diggin', Mr. Harlequin hauling, because I'm going to leave it in the ground. Mr. Taft can dig and Mr. Harley can haul and Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. It's gonna take a lot of long and an 80 short day for this miner to cool on down. Mr. Taft can dig and Mr. Harley can haul it, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
you give a guy who has everything?
Labor history, of course.
And where can you get a great dose of labor history?
Right here, weeknights from 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show.
From New York City factories to West Virginia coal mines to Oregon loading docks to Toledo glass factories, you'll hear all the stories right here, right up until the new year.
And then we'll be back with all new shows here on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside there's feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard a Republican today? Have you tried to spread your love to those who love the NRA? Though they might be quite reluctant, cause they'll wonder if you're gay. You should hug a Republican today.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, download the podcast there at the website. Or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. People's Tour for America here in Detroit, Michigan. We're at the historic Teamster Building where the original James R. Hoffa, this is his office. I actually got to sit behind the desk. Pretty amazing moment for me. We're here with Erkesha Terry. She's the AFL-CIO's labor liaison with the United Way here of southeastern Michigan. And, you know, one of the things that I love about labor is they do so much that we never hear about, which is why we've asked Erkesha to come talk to us. Erkesha, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I always point to, right after Hurricane Katrina, Walmart sent $8 million worth of water in their trucks down to New Orleans. $8 million. And they spent $18 million telling me that they sent $8 million worth of water down to Katrina. And it just goes to show that, you know, where the importance lies in making sure that I know. But labor doesn't do that.
You know what? You're absolutely right. And I just think historically, the labor community and union folks, they're really humble. They just want to get the work done. They want to help people, but they don't want to take credit for it. And I think therein is where the problem lies.
So what we need to do for the next couple of minutes, because I do believe in blowing labor's horn. I do believe in saying, you know, hey, this is what's important. This is what they've done. And this is what they should be given credit for. So, you know, as you look at your time as labor liaison, give me some of the good stuff you've been doing.
Well, some of the good stuff that we do, we volunteer with different organizations. If they're such as Habitat for Humanity, we'll have some of our union folks come and help with buildings of the homes. We also have a program called the Ray West Memorial Wheelchair Ramp Program right here in southeast Michigan. Bill Helwig, who is a labor liaison, such as myself, he actually rounds up union volunteers to go out in southeast Michigan to build wheelchair ramps for folks that can't afford to get ramps built on their own. These are beautiful ramps, and generally they last pretty much, they're pretty sustainable. And folks that have been trapped in their homes for 5, 10, 15 years, they just feel a sense of freedom because they're actually able to get out of the house, even to get to the mailbox or just
to sit outside.
And so these are some of the things that we take for granted. But it's a great program, and we're always looking for volunteers. But union members are generally stepping up to the plate. They put together teams, and they'll come out, and they'll volunteer. As a matter of fact, we had the UAW have a group of Ford guys to come on to the program for about a year. They were working with Bill building wheelchair ramps.
Yeah, as I'm sitting here listening to you say this, I'm going, you know, why is it as a community we aren't doing this for our citizens? Why isn't this part of what our government does for us? Why does it have to be volunteers? But I'm glad they do.
Right.
But, you know, you go back and you go, why does it have to be the charity of others? And, you know, we never hear about that, but why does it have to be that way?
You know, I think people may have the mindset that, well, somebody else is going to do it. I don't have to do it because somebody else is going to do it. And if that mindset is pervasive, then it never gets done.
Or it's not my problem.
Or it's not my problem. And so somebody has to step forward and say, you know what, this person needs help, and it's my job as a citizen to do something. And that's what being a union member is all about. That's what labor is all about, helping folks in community. Because at the end of the day, we are a part of this community.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've got a number of listeners who have sent me emails because we've talked about different unions that have food banks in their union halls. And, you know, a lot of the unions that I was a part of, they actually had license to be food banks for, you know, for when strikes happen and when there are catastrophes. And, you know, the emails that I got are saying, well, that's amazing. I had never heard of unions having food pantries that actually fed the community. I'm going, that's because they don't toot their own horn enough.
Right, right. And it's a shame. I think we are starting to figure it out, that we really have to get the word out that we're doing really good work, because union members seem to have, you know, people have stereotypes and preconceived notions about what the union is about. But again, we're a part of the community. We want to make sure that people are earning living wages, folks that are struggling, that there's a safety net for those folks. And if we can help, we want to do that. But the gap there is we just don't publicize it. But I think now we're starting to figure out these are some of the things that we need to start doing to change the image of organized labor.
You know, what's interesting to me, as you were talking, I'm thinking about, you know, as you're saying, you know, we just want to get things done. And I'm thinking back to the Walmart example that I use, you know, the $8 million they spent on the water and the $18 million that they spent on PR. I would think your group would take that resource and use the $18 million to get more water and
right.
not worry about who knew. And, you know, it goes back to what my grandfather always said, you know, if you're doing something, you don't have to worry. If you're doing what's right, you don't have to worry about who's watching. And don't do something knowing someone's watching.
Right.
Always do the right thing. And, you know, I guess it comes back down to that for me, because he was a union man for years as well. I guess it comes back down to that way of thinking.
Right, it does. And I think that speaks to a person's character. And if you're going to do something, whether someone's watching or whether they're not watching, you just want to do the right thing. But again, because things have changed in our world, I think we really need to kind of step up and say, you know what, we're still humble folks. But we just want to let folks know that we are doing good in our community.
And there's an awful lot to do here in the Detroit area. And as we look around with the poverty and the blight and all the things, there's an awful lot to be done.
It is.
And I understand you guys are doing this meetup and eat-up campaign. Tell me about that.
Wow, this is a great program, and we've kicked it off. It's called the Meetup and Eat-Up. We kicked it off this summer, and it's where we can actually partner with area churches, other organizations, rec centers, and schools that are open during the summertime. And these are sites where folks can send their kids if they're 18 and under. Some of these sites provide free breakfast and lunch for kids, and some provide lunch. But it's just a way for folks to be able to sort of fill that hole during the summertime when they can't afford maybe to feed their kids. And it's a way for kids to be socialized and have fun with other kids at these sites. So we're really excited about the program because we want to get the word out to our members who may be struggling and also other folks in the community. So it's just a great program. And this particular program, from what we understand, is not in jeopardy of losing funding. So that's what we're really excited about.
You know what's great about this program? And what was great about it before Ronald Reagan destroyed it is that you're right. It fed millions of people across our country. And you go back to, you know, I was a kid growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I remember this being part of the Johnson Great Society, where you go to the local public school and there would be that place where at least once a day, every kid in our community got a hot lunch. And for many of them, it was the only hot lunch the only hot meal they got for the day. And when Reagan came in, they destroyed that. And so when I see this, I'm thinking back to my own history going, I'm glad someone's doing it, but again, it shouldn't be up to charity. It shouldn't be up to the goodwill. It should just be.
You're absolutely right. And just thinking about if you add it up, if you multiply how much money folks could save on food, and maybe put that money towards an electric bill or something that may be getting shut off in the home, it makes a big difference.
So, you know, as you, how'd you get, I guess the first question I have, how'd you get involved in this? I mean, this, you know, this seems like a daunting task. It seems like, it seems to me something that I would want to do every day, but how'd you get involved in it?
Well, actually, before I came to United Way, I would do things with my church. I would do things with other auxiliary groups, but never really thought that, oh, this is something that I could actually do on a daily basis. I was given the opportunity to come on with United Way as a union member. I'm a member of CWA 3422, and specifically my role is to connect union members to resources and services that are available in Southeast Michigan. Also, to let other union members that want to get involved in community services to sort of give them the tools that they need to help other folks that work in their particular plant. It may be in a grocery store, whatever facility that is. We want to make sure that we equip folks with the tools that they need to help their fellow union members. So we provide training opportunities. We put on classes. There's always something to do. There's always something to do. And the one great thing that I love about being a liaison is that every day is different. One of the things that we do that a lot of folks don't know is if there is a plant closing or if there's a layoff, we actually work with a representative with the state of Michigan called a rapid response. They'll call us in if that facility has union members. And we make sure that we bring to the table resources that we may have to help those folks until they're able to find something else. So that's one of the big things that people don't know that we do as labor liaisons.
Yeah, that, and it sounds like a vital, because most people, I don't think, know how to navigate their way through the unemployment system. When I got, the last time I got laid off, and I'll tell you how long ago it was, I actually went down to an unemployment office. And there was someone behind a desk who shoved a form at me, and you filled out the form. Those are all gone, long eviscerated, at least in Pennsylvania. I don't know how it is in Michigan. Everything's now done online, and I guess you first got to find the website, let alone know how to navigate it. So it's, I guess it's important to have someone who can help you navigate those waters.
Oh, it is just amazing how overwhelmed people can be, especially if you've been working on a job 10, 15, 20 years, and all of a sudden they tell you in a week or two that your job is going to be eliminated. You certainly don't know where to start, and again, you're angry, you have a range of emotions, and it is. It's daunting. And you're like, oh, my goodness, I need some help. And so that's when we come in and we'll bring in organizations that say, we provide these services. Make sure you call us or come and see us because we can make sure that we can get your family food. Make sure you come and see us if you're having some legal issues. So we want to make sure that folks have resources that they can go to once they sort of grasp what's going on with them and take the time to go through the material and call folks that can really help them.
You've got to have tons of stories of people that you've helped. You know, because, you know, you think about all the charitable work that people do. And, you know, I talk to folks all the time. You know, they have that one story, that one thing that makes them go, you know, this was all worth it. Can you share one of those stories with us? Something that you made you go, you know, this is the reason I do this.
Well, I remember a few years ago, I was working with one of the other liaisons at a corporation called American Axle, and they were completely about to shut down. And there was a young lady who was in dire straits. She said, they're going to shut off, you know, my electricity. I have three kids. I don't know what to do. We were able to connect them with, I believe it was the Heat and Warmth Fund, also some other organizations. She was able to have her services, were able to stay on for like the next 3 or 4 months. And she sent us, I think she called or sent an email saying that she never would have known any of those resources were available had it not been for our program. And what made a difference is that we were at that plant every day until folks stopped coming to the table or they found another job. But we just wanted folks to know that we're here. If you want to talk to us one-on-one, we can, you know, help you in any way we can. So she said, I just really appreciate seeing you guys coming down to the union hall every day. And that made a difference and also with the resources that we connected her with. So that was, that made me feel good because, you know, when you're seeing folks getting laid off and then all of a sudden something clicks, something happens for a person because, you know, you can give it your best shot and sometimes it doesn't work out. But our job is to point people in the right direction and to make sure that they can get some type of assistance, even if it's just a small amount.
Or even just to be there to listen.
Right.
I mean, you know, some of the people I've talked to over the years say, you know, look, I might not be able to help, but, you know, I can at least give you that shoulder or that ear.
Right, right. So that in itself is just rewarding because I always think to myself, wow, I'm so fortunate. That could be me.
Well, you know, Keisha, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work that you do, and thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thanks for having me.
We're going to take a quick break here from Detroit, Michigan. The People's Tour for America, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
We got to get older tonight. We got to do it today.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
So Rick's off to Florida with his family. We'll be playing encore performances of the People's Tour right through the new year.
No, wait, I'm still here.
Rick, what are you doing here?
Well, Pat, I wanted to make sure that we were playing the People's Tour while I'm gone.
Rick, you and everyone else can rest assured that each night from 9 until midnight, we'll hear some of the very best interviews from our trip across the country, exploring labor history.
Right here, 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, the podcast there at the website, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone, take the program on the go. We're in St. Louis, Missouri at Joint Council 13's Hall, and they also share it with Teamsters Local 618. You know, Pat, whenever I come to places like that, I like to talk to the people who've been there for quite a number of years. My grandfather was a retired Teamster. At some point, I hope to retire. I'm not sure that's ever going to happen, given the what's going
given
on with Social Security and how little I work.
Yeah.
That's part of it. Or how insane I've become as a workaholic. But I like to talk to people who've made it to that finish line, made it to the line where, you know what, now I can do what I want to do as opposed to what I have to do. And that's why we've got Ronald Goshleff Sr. He's the president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Local 600 Golden Age Retiree Club. Ron, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
So president of the Retiree Club, what do you guys do?
Well, to start this off right, I'd like to read a quote that was sent to me, and I, the person that sent it to me, I'm sure guaranteed that it's authentic, but I guess it can be checked. But I'd like to read this, if I could.
Sure.
We must close union offices, confiscate their money, and put their leaders in prison. We must reduce workers' salaries and take away their right to strike. Now, I guess you can try to guess who that was. I'll give you his initials and then tell you who it was. It was said May 2nd, 1933. The initials are A.H. He was a political dictator who I hope is burning in hell. That would be Adolf Hitler.
He was also the 1932 Time Magazine Man of the Year.
Correct. Which wasn't correct. But anyway.
Which shows you that really bad people can get a lot of popular support.
Unfortunately, I simply ask people and my brothers and sisters out there, especially those that are retired, I simply say, have you heard anything that resembles those remarks from state to state, from coast to coast? I'm sure you could probably quote, especially some of those that are in what's known as the so-called red states. If this sounds political, it is, and I want it to be.
As it should be. You know, I go back to my grandparents' generation who gave us a middle class. I mean, my grandfather came back from World War II. They beat A.H. and brought back that sense of community and said, hey, you know what, the Depression, all the suffering that we did those years, we want part of the spoils, if you will. We want to be able to support our families. We want a better future for our kids. And as I looked to the next generation for my kids, I wonder if that's going to be possible for my kids.
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons why I am very much involved with the retirees. I retired 2001. I retired with 33 years. I retired from my job, but I certainly didn't retire from the Teamsters Union. I'm still very much involved and active with the retirees. And what one of the main things that I'm involved with is trying to motivate and instigate, I guess, the retirees, because so many of them come to retirees meetings, and they have a right to do this. They put in their time with dignity. They retired. And they have a right to do this. They want to play cards. They want to talk about driving the trucks. They want to talk about unloading. And they want to talk about some of their experiences and some of the problems they had with supervisors and dispatchers.
And make up a bunch of stories along the way about mattresses and stuff along the way.
Correct. Teamsters are known for being, you know, locker room experts. There's no question, no question about that. I guess what scares me most about this is that there's not a whole lot of people that are involved today, and I refer, you know, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way because this doesn't fit everybody, but they don't seem to have this alliance or this linkage. I can tell you with absolutely no hesitation that I'm not a choir boy. I grew up in an environment that was not known for singing in the choir.
I grew up in a neighborhood where you beat up the choir boy.
Right. I know what it's like to be on a picket line. I know what it's like to get sapped. I know what it's like to get thrown in the back of a paddy wagon. That's what they used to call it. I've been put in a room and given the good cop, bad cop routine. I've been told all kinds of little stories. So I have a little bit of a background. I'm proud of it. I haven't been killed yet. Obviously, I'm here. Some of them probably wished I was, but at the time, I can remember one incident once in the city of Kirkwood, Missouri, where at that time we were boycotting the grapes. And the Kroger store they were, of course, selling grapes, non-union grapes, and we were in support of the farm workers. And I remember being outside on the picket line, and I remember this guy driving up and stopping at the picket line instead of going through like they normally do. He decided he wanted to have a confrontation. Well, he did. He started eating grapes and then spitting the seeds out, and he spit the seeds out at me. Well, being a good boy that my mom always taught me, you know, I mean, I did something about that. I'll let your imagination go, but at the same time, I was arrested, put in the back of a squad car, and taken to the local jail. And lo and behold, my union, within a matter of hours, I was out. And so I know very well what it was like. I'm sure that a lot of that goes on in a different way now. And my concern is that maybe, and I know some people are going to get a little upset about this, we don't have enough of this. And I'm talking about my position when this guy spit the seed out at me.
Oh, I've said it a million times, you know. Maybe we need to go back to when I was a kid. As my grandfather always said, sometimes you got to smack somebody and make a citizen out of them.
Well, Abe Lincoln's got a good story about that. Remember him when he supposedly was walking down a road and saw this farmer who had a mule. And he was pulling and pulling on this mule, and the mule wouldn't move. So old Abe reached over and got a big old piece of the fence, hauled off and hit that mule right square in the head. And the farmer was just like, what are you doing? He says, well, first I got to get his attention, and then we'll talk. Maybe that's what labor has to do today, because they have totally economically raped us. That's the only way I can look at it. Todd Akin in this great state of Missouri, you know, with his legitimate rape crap, I say they've done it to us, folks. They've done it to us.
And they've made it legitimate, too.
Yes, exactly. We're going back to the 30s. We're going back when we were fighting. Think about this. This is 2013, and we're fighting and concerned about whether we can give people that need it more than $7.35 an hour or $8 an hour. The fast food workers, they wanted $9 and $10 an hour. Think about that. Think about whether you can live on that. Think what you can buy. And at the same time, the United Mine Workers, who worked in those holes in the ground, the most dangerous job in the world, they believed in the corporation promises. And lo and behold,
right here
in the state of Missouri, they screwed them.
And we're going to be in Fairmont, West Virginia, July 9th for the mine workers event.
Exactly.
Because, you know, and you're talking about the Peabody and the Patriot bankruptcy, where they just, as we've talked about on the program, they stole these people's pension and their retirement health care.
Exactly.
No other way of putting it, but pure and simple theft.
There's no doubt about it, as far as I'm concerned. We've got to stop this. I don't know what it's going to take. As a retiree, my main concern is to try to get the retirees involved, as I said. And I'm getting a lot of help. I'm getting a lot of.
Well, let me ask you this, Ron, because, you know, the retirees, you know, I see it as the retirees are being pitted against the younger generation, as the wealth class does. They do a very good job of dividing and slicing and dicing us up and pitting us against each other. And I know real soon here in the St. Louis area, you're going to be helping out with the Missouri Alliance for Retired Americans. They're going to have an event, you know, against this chain CPI, and they're going to have a human chain against chain CPI. What do you say to the younger person who goes, well, I don't care about Social Security. It's not going to be there for me. I'll have a better chance of seeing a UFO than I will a Social Security check.
Well, again, you know, okay, put your fingers in your ears, folks. That's all pure bull, pure and simple propaganda. And every person that tells you, you know, nothing's going to be here and it's nothing but a ripoff, as far as, you know, the poor corporation bosses and, you know, they can't make their money and we're going bankrupt and we ain't going to have any money. You've got 10 on the other side, our side, that say that's, you know, hogwash. It's not true. There are simple things that can be done to salvage Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, but they don't want to hear this because the bottom line is pure and simple. It's nothing but they want to make the most money, and they want to, the only way they can do that is to keep the workers at the lowest possible wage, so they can get rid of their benefits, they can get rid of their medical. You know, when I've been involved with negotiations, and one of the things that I can remember many years ago, sitting on a negotiation with Harold Gibbons, and we were negotiating a contract with United Parcel Service, which is not a fly-by-night outfit, and they're 100% union, and they're Teamsters, you know.
And very profitable.
Exactly. And I remember, during that, one of the things one of the big boys did, and I was just, you know, coming up, he said, you know what, Ron, we don't care what you make. That's not important. We'll pass it on down. What we're concerned about is your health and welfare, your pensions, your medical benefits. That's what we don't like. And this is what they're trying, one of the things they're trying to do in this country with things when they put this chain thing on this, on Social Security. They're trying to destroy any possibilities of workers in this country being able to retire with dignity, a livable wage, and being able to take care of their family. Why are they denying us this? Why is it important that we, in my industry, probably the majority of the guys in my industry make less than 50 grand a year. If they're lucky with overtime, maybe they make 50 grand a year. Most of them probably don't. But then you're going to tell me that that's too much and they can't have any benefits, but it's okay for another guy to make millions and billions of dollars.
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah. That's,
see, because if you have money in your pocket, if you're secure and you're comfortable, you might actually become Ronald Gusheff, the guy who's going to stand up and fight back. You might be that guy who's going to be in the street saying, hell no, we're not going to take any more. You may be the guy off the treadmill for a day, and we can't have that. We need that guy constantly like the rabbit in the, or like the
hamster
in the wheel. We need that because you're looking down. You're not seeing how you're being robbed and ripped off and Social Security being taken and Medicare being destroyed and all of the other things that are going on. You're not seeing it because you're on that wheel.
So what you're telling me then, and what I've been trying to convey to the retirees, is that somebody's lying. Somebody's lying. Somebody's not telling the truth. So that, what are we now? Are we going to go back to the plantation servitude of, you know, hey, your company store? Is that what we're going to do? We're going to revert everything back to the 1930s and even before that? where you walk in and the boss says, you know, do you do this today? And that's it. If you don't like it, there's a door, hit it. All we're saying is, just like some of your interviewees that were telling you before, there's nothing between us and the street and the most minimal of minimum wages. I mean, who's going to fight the corporations? Who's going to say to them, look, you guys, you know, how many new suits can you wear? How many goddamn, houses can you buy?
But why do we need to fight the corporations? They're so wonderful and benevolent. Yeah. They give us these things. They give us health care, and they give us pensions and wages. They give those to us.
Yeah, and they also call them vulture capitalists. And along with that, they are never satisfied. They're never satisfied. I mean, you know, $12,025 grand a year. Think about it. Just out there, you know, and if he can make $50 grand a year, and something happens to the corporation that he works for, they decide to go out of business.